brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about the minimum wage. Should we be increasing the minimum wage? What, 8, 10, 12 bucks an hour, maybe 15? Bring up the bottom, make sure everyone makes a decent livable wage. Should we be doing that? I think so, yes. But we will find out. Also, paid sick days. Should they be illegal? Should we not allow local communities to say, hey, we'd like to make sure that the employers in our neck of the woods provide them? I definitely think they should not be illegal. Also, Papa Janny's got their panties in a twist, if you remember, over the Affordable Care Act. And some interesting numbers now showing why corporate America should keep their nose out of policy. Also, a return to the fight for FDR's Four Freedoms and a second Bill of Rights. And I'm a firm believer of we need, you know, sandwiched between FDR's Four Freedoms speech and LBJ's war on poverty, we should be looking at how do we get to that next level where we have the next New Deal, the next Great Society plan. How do we get to that place where we are actually looking at the interests of average, everyday Joe Sixpack and lunch pail folks so that they can support their families and retire with some dignity and share, really, share in the wealth that their labor creates. I'm going to talk about that. Also, unemployment extension appears to be heading in the right direction, but I know what I want to know. I want to know, what are we giving up? What's it going to cost for this three-month extension? What's the pound of flesh? What's the future going to cost us? The devil in the details as it passes the Senate. We'll talk a little bit about that. I'm going to take your questions, your calls, comments, whatever's on your mind tonight. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the program at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Cold. So I guess the question, and I can't tell you how many times I heard it. Is it cold enough for you today? No, it's not. No, I wish I was in Fargo, North Dakota, where it's 32 below. Or Madison, Wisconsin, where it's 21 below. Or even Minneapolis or Chicago, where it was reportedly 15 below zero. And that's not even with the wind chill. The wind chill has put it up somewhere around a negative 60 degrees. Yes, it was quite cold enough for me. Thank you very much. And even down south, they're seeing this polar vortex screwing up their weather. And again, you know, you have these conversations where it's a cold enough for you. Yes, it is. And then the very next comment goes, well, do you still believe in global warming? I believe that there is climate change going on. Yes. And I do believe. And of course, the next question is, well, do you believe we did it? And well, common sense would say maybe. Yes. And maybe we should stop some of the things we're doing, some of the things that we can actually change, maybe think about that. So you get this conversation. Well, it's colder than Mars, according to one Weather Channel reporter. Colder than Mars. And you get people saying, well, so you know such a thing as global warming. Well, not quite. According to bioanthropologist Greg Layden, who does some writing over at the National Geographic's science blog, his article titled, Go Home Arctic, You're Drunk, he basically says, look, this polar vortex, this huge system that's of swirling air moving across our area, normally is the polar cold air. It's shifted from the poles, the really cold area, to us. He says what we are not seeing an expansion of cold, an ice age, or an anti-global warming phenomenon. He says we're seeing the usual cold polar air taking an excursion. He says, so this cold weather we are having does not disprove global warming. It's just that the weather seems to be a bit drunk. Some scientists have said that the influx of the extreme cold is actually one of the effects of climate change. That as the globe gets warmer, as it's moister, as the temperatures change, you're going to end up with this kind of extremes. And this is the thing that, you know, you look at and you go, is when Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, says, well, we'll just we'll just figure our way out of it. You know, we've evolved. We'll adapt. I think about disaster capitalism, you know, all of the destruction that we're doing. Who's going to make the money off of it? I think of all the people right now who are homeless. I think of all the people who don't have enough heat. I think of all the people who, you know, they're struggling, man. This weather is a killer. What's going to happen to them? What's going to happen to people who are making minimum wage, can't afford to turn the heat on? What's going to happen to people who are homeless and have nowhere to go? As we've cut budgets for every bit of social program, the LIHEAP, the homeless shelters, as we've cut all this money, are the churches going to do it? Well, for a short period, perhaps. But understand, they're not capable of taking on the kind of responsibility or the kind of need that we have in this country. So I look at today and I think of all of those people who are struggling. I mean, it was so cold today, I actually saw a teenager with his pants up right around his waist. I thought I'd never see that. And I think about the people who have to work outside. And I remember, you know, my days when I used to work on a shipping dock. One of the places, and it was a horrible, horrible condition job. I worked throwing boxes on a shipping dock in Cleveland that was, you know, close to the lake, to where when it was cold like this, you'd get that mist coming off the lake and you'd be basically frozen like a popsicle. Fortunately, we had a union that said, you know, every hour you've got a 10-minute break. I gotta wonder how many employers who have their employees working outside are going, go out, take a break, or how many of them are saying, get to work, get it done, I don't care. You kind of got to wonder. And I look at these horrible conditions and I say, you know, this is the time when we need each other the most. This is the time when you need government programs. And yes, I'm going to say that because I'm a firm believer in the New Deal worked, the Great Society worked, the War on Poverty worked, unemployment, Social Security, these things worked and are working. Although under attack, it is something that we need to be talking about and really expanding. And it's extreme events like this that make me say more than ever we need to have an active government of, for, and by we the people, that we make sure we take care of each other. And also laws. You know, I remember when I was working on the docks, we knew places like in Massachusetts, for instance, that mandated that when temperatures fell below a certain, like now, that you had to get a break every so often, that there had to be shelter and there had to be heated areas. I don't know that Pennsylvania has any of those things, because I remember working on the docks here, there was none of that. Fortunately, again, you know, you go back, the unions had your back on this stuff. But I have to ask, you have to wonder. And as we're seeing the destruction of collective bargaining and the assault on workers' rights and the voice on the job, what's going to happen in the future? And I know, you know, it's these extreme events that make you think about those things. And that's why over the weekend I was out on the roads and I was grateful for the plow in front of me, the state worker who was out there working 20, 24 hours to make sure that the roads were safe. The rescue crews who came out in the bitter cold, and the rescue crews who are out on the roads tonight. Look, if you don't have to go out tonight, sit home, listen to the radio. Sit home, give us a call here and tell us what you're thinking. But don't go out. Don't endanger someone else if you get into an accident. And, you know, I see these folks who, you know, they've got their four-wheel drive. I'm driving my four-wheel drive vehicle. I'm invincible. And I can't tell you how many times over the years I've seen these four-wheelers go blasting by me at 70, 80 miles an hour in snow and ice. And then you find them on the side of the road, on the side of their car, waiting for one of those public servants to come and rescue them, one of those public servants to come and save them, putting their life at risk. So, you know, if they're out there, hats off to our public servants. Thank you for the work you do, even if our legislature wants to steal your pension. So tonight on the program, we're going to focus a little bit on that, but I want to talk about economic issues. I mean, sandwiched right between FDR's For Freedom speech and tomorrow LBJ beginning his thoughts in 1964 on the war on poverty. What direction should we be going today as a society? What should the minimums be now? And how do we get there? With the divided government we've got right now, with the corporatists who control and own most of our legislatures across the state, across the country, the way the gridlock's going on in Washington, what should we be doing? Do we go back to the days of Coxey's Army where the unemployed march to D.C. and set up camp? Do we take to the streets? Big fan of that myself. You know, if the 1.3 million people who've lost their unemployment extension hasn't passed yet, just passed a hurdle in the Senate, if they don't get their benefits, what happens to those 1.3 million people? If I was one of them, I would say, let's get to the curb. Let's get out there and make some noise. And the 2.2 million people in the coming year who are going to lose their benefits as well, into the streets. Because that's the only way things get done, it seems. When those in Washington or in Harrisburg, in the corporate boardrooms, and in the CEO suites, when they think that their heads could end up on a platter or on a stick out in front of the Capitol, that's when things get done. You know, I don't think President Obama's talking about, hey, we need to increase the minimum wage and make sure that people have a decent living and that raising the unemployment, returning the unemployment benefits is a no-brainer, as he put it. I don't think he's doing that because, he's just a great guy. I think he's doing it because people are pushing him. And this is what we need to be doing to these elected officials. We need to be pushing them in the right direction. And if they don't go that direction, well, we get them out to the curb and the unemployment line with them. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's really a corporate extortion plan by Boeing trying to make aerospace a race to the bottom. 7,000 to 8,000 members didn't vote on it, and it was such a slim margin. 300 votes either way would have changed it. That means about 37.5% of the members actually got to decide the fate for the next 10 years, which erases 78 years of collective bargaining history.
International Association of Machinists, District 751 spokesperson Connie Kelleher. Many IAM District 751 Boeing machinists are very angry about the vote forced on them by their international union that destroyed defined benefit pensions, increased health care costs, and diminished wages. Some members have filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board and are demanding a re-vote when a true majority of IAM Boeing members would have a chance to cast ballots. Kelleher says that due to members being away on holidays vacation, about 25% of members didn't vote on this concessionary contract proposal.
Members are very upset. There's been a huge outcry since Friday's vote was announced from members calling for a revote. Our international president forced this vote under the guise of he wanted the members to have the final say on it. Well, if you want the members to have the final say, don't pick a day where you know 25 to 30% of them are not available. A lot of people are very upset and have gone to the NLRB. They are passing around petitions that they want to call for a revote when truly a majority of the members could determine the fate. Our international president has said all along that he responds to hearing from the members, so right now the members are busy speaking up and letting him hear them.
Kelleher says the contract Boeing forced on workers under threat of moving the production of the 777X airliner was corporate extortion that squeezed both the workers and $8.7 billion in tax concessions. pensions from Washington State. And she says despite this being portrayed as giving up pensions and other concessions in return for guaranteed jobs, there is no real ironclad jobs guarantee for future Washington State union jobs from Boeing in this contract.
For a two-paragraph language giving us the airplane, the first sentence says we get the work, and the next two paragraphs give them loopholes to move it. It not only gave up the defined benefit pension, it destroyed the health care, really. The premiums will go up 300% by the end, copays will double, all policies drop to 90% coverage on everything. In addition, wage growth is cut by 75% from the current contract, which was only a 2% wage increase each year. It'll now be 1% every other year, and then it'll go 3 years.
Meanwhile, Boeing is making record profits. The CEO got a 20% raise last year, and he has a pension that will pay him $265,000 a month when he retires, and a supplemental pension on top of that. IAM International President Tom Buffenbarger was not available for an interview, but the International says the $8.7 billion in legislative incentives in Washington State are contingent on Boeing remaining in Puget Sound. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us, because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education, like, better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
We took the money out, according to Representative Helm. We took the money out, but we put it all back. Honest, trust us. Put it all back. It's all back. You know, those 20,000 teachers that got fired because the money had been taken away, they left because they wanted to. Wow. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com, and we want to bring private people in because we're going to privatize education. That's the Republican way. Privatize and profitize everything so that a handful benefit, and you and I, well, we pick up the tab. Congratulations. You're making the wealth class, well, wealthier. Sad, sad stuff. But the good thing is we are seeing a Democratic Party that seems to be a little energized. I mean, sandwiched between FDR's Four Freedoms speech and LBJ's war on poverty, we're seeing a Democratic Party who's saying, hey, maybe we should be looking at raising the minimum wage. Maybe we should be helping working people, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Eddie Day Pashinsky to come talk to us. Eddie, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's a pleasure. Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
Did you have a good holiday? Did you ring in the new year right?
I always ring it in right with hope and a prayer that it's going to get better, because 2013 wasn't so good.
Yeah, you're right.
At least not for the regular working folks.
I know
it's been a tough year.
I know a lot of people suffering and struggling, and you know, you look at the fact that on the federal level, the federal extension for unemployment benefits still not done. The SNAP benefits not there. So much uncertainty for people who are already struggling and having a tough time for it on the federal level. Just an abomination. But the sad reality to me, Eddie, is it doesn't seem to be all that much better on the state level.
Well, it's a sad day when we as Americans have forgotten, you know, our heart. And this is not a handout. These are working class folks that are having tough times. You know what? We could eliminate all of this if there were jobs.
Yep.
So, you know what? If these people wouldn't have to look forward to collecting unemployment insurance, which they paid into, by the way, and many of these people have worked for decades, and I'm sure your listeners know, through no fault of their own, they lost these jobs, and you cannot find jobs, especially when you're up in age, when you start getting into your 50s, and certainly in your 60s, it becomes difficult. Look, the bottom line, I heard what you said in the beginning. Everything's been focused in on helping corporate America. But the idea was if we helped corporate America, then there would be jobs. The problem is there aren't the jobs that should be there. And as a result, these people are just looking for a lifeline in order to survive until they can try to find something or change their life in some way that they can actually exist.
Yeah.
And notice used the word exist. It seems as though the main plan is to continue to squeeze the working class to a point where all the money goes to that upper echelon. And I want to make it clear, look, I have no problem with people who are successful, but I do have a problem with people that are greedy, that only want more, that do not need more. The people right now on that unemployment, unemployment insurance, they need it. Not that they want it, they need it in order to survive. It's a sad day in America.
I'm with you. And the fact that we have a paltry minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, which hasn't been raised here in the state of Pennsylvania since 2006. I mean, here we are, more than 7 years later, I mean, going on eight, since the minimum wage was increased. And inflation has basically just eaten most of it away. And look, I got to be honest, I have no idea how you exist, let alone live on what the minimum wage pays. But right now seems more than ever something we should be increasing and forthright.
Well, it used to be the kids used to be working in your fast food restaurants. Now you see young adults, you see mothers. People are taking it for a second job. People are working two and three jobs in order to survive. It's not that people don't want to work. The work isn't there that pays a living wage.
Yeah.
And that also is another concern, and you and I have talked about it at length, and that is they're trying to eliminate the unions, because the unions have been a unified force, not just for union people, for all Americans, because as the unions were able to save quality jobs and maintain living wages and benefits, that also improved wages and benefits for the non-union people as well. So I think I would like your audience to think about it this way. When people begin to demonize unions, they're demonizing their neighbor. These are people that when they get paid union wages, they buy their house in America, they pay their taxes in America, they buy their food and clothes in America. They do not take their money and put it on an offshore account.
No, nothing in the Caymans? You don't have any money in the Caymans?
Not me, buddy. Not me. Not the people that I know. And again, more power to the folks that are able to do that, as long as you're doing the American thing. And the American thing, really, is hire people. If you got that business and you're doing well, let's get another business going so you can hire Americans. It's only a part of economic decision-making and structure whereby people that work buy products, therefore the economy grows. A quality economic standard that, for some reason, the Republicans just aren't willing to initiate. They don't want to give this president a win, you know, and they don't want to give the regular working folks a break.
Do you think that's what it is? It's the black guy in the White House?
Every day, more and more, it seems that. They don't want to give him a win at all. And, you know, I understand the conflict between parties, between ideologies, but at what cost? When you're jeopardizing the entire country's economic welfare, the security of this country, I think that is not only wrong, I think it's treason. When those legislators know they have the power to fix things and all they're doing right now is sabotaging things, I'm sorry. That is an act of aggression, in my opinion. It's a form of treason when you're hurting 300 million people.
So do you ever think, that, I mean, because you're a little bit older than I am, you probably remember when both parties seemed to have some common ground. You know, I go back, and you're not this old, but I go back to a letter that Dwight David Eisenhower wrote to his brother where he said, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear from that party again in our political history. He writes, there is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believe you can do these things, among them a few Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their numbers are negligible, and they are stupid. It seems that stupid is running our country because look what's going on the federal level. They want to cut Social Security. They want to gut Social Security. They don't want to extend unemployment benefits. They're trying to gut labor laws and make basically being a union member illegal in this country. And the Farm Bill, geez. So,
well,
is there ever
up,
Is there a point where the parties ever come back to the common ground that Eisenhower articulated there?
I wish we had Eisenhower Republicans. We could fix a lot of things with that, because I know the Democrats that I'm associated with wants to fix things. Let me just say this to you. This is a very difficult time in our human growth period. But, you know, when you look back at World War II, the stock market crash at 29, World War I, our ancestors worked hard, suffered, bled, died for what we have today. This is our cross, Rick. This is our cross to bear. We have to have the courage to stand up and fight for all the things that we believe in. One of the most frustrating things about being a politician is we know a great deal of things that are happening within our political circle. And we try to get that message out to the people, because ultimately it's the people that elect their representatives, their senators, their presidents, and those are the people then that create the laws that affect the people. What's been happening is the people are busy trying to survive. And I don't think anybody that has, you know, an ounce of common sense would believe there is this kind of maniacal plan to ruin the system that we have, a complete takeover by these humongously wealthy and powerful people. So until the people finally figure it out, I always say, unfortunately, until the people finally get hurt from it, that's when they will rise up against it. That's when you will see the sea change. Frankly, on a national level, I'm beginning to see that now.
Yeah.
The Republicans don't seem to be quite as hard in their position. And, of course, it's an election year. Thank God for an election year.
Right.
Now they have to watch what they do so the people don't vote them out of office. That's where the power of the people comes in. And, you know, what you do in this show is vital. It is absolutely critical that the people get the right information, because they're given so much, they get confused on who's telling the truth. And that's part of the game plan, too. Confuse the people, fool the people, get in, and then do whatever the heck you want. And I'm not saying, you know, everybody in politics is Lily White. We certainly know that isn't true. This is a tough arena that we have to work in. But, you know, I always believe that there's more good in people than bad. Right now, it seems as though there's more bad that's involved and that's in power than good.
And
you know, so.
And for me, Eddie, it comes back to.
I'm just saying, all I'm saying is don't give up hope. The people will rise again. We will all rise again and do the right thing.
I'm with you. I think eventually, you know, to take an old labor saying, there's only so much you know what people are willing to eat. And when you get to that point, you know, that's when you'll see the boots in the street. But, you know, I look at this, and to me it comes back down to the money. When you see the Koch brothers and their ilk spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars on front groups and think tanks and all of this messaging and all this money on politics to privatize everything, at some point there's gotta be a societal reaction to turn away from that, because, you know, I look at all the money that's in this state pushing assaults on workers, pushing the privatization of our lottery, our liquor stores, our turnpike, you name it, whatever's not nailed down, they want to hock off to the lowest bidder of who will make the highest profits. At some point, I hope we turn around and say, enough, expel the myths that have been sold to us and seek a new way.
Well, I think the people told Governor Corbett, lay off the lottery. You know, that was a bad idea. And to privatize the management of that would have cost the people of Pennsylvania hundreds of millions of dollars. I think the people said to them, look, we want you to modernize our liquor store system, but we don't want you to privatize it to the point where we're going to be losing, again, hundreds of millions of dollars. And there's nothing wrong with extending the hours, creating more time on Sunday, making sure that our liquor stores are, you know, in or near food stores. We can do all those things without having to privatize it. But remember, when you privatize, those people that own it, by the way, forget about mom and pop owning these things. It's going to be the big stores that are going to buy everybody out, and then they're going to do whatever they want, and they're going to charge the people whatever they want.
Yep.
So, you know, again, you can't fool all of the people all the time. You know, that old adage, fool some of the time, et cetera, that is so true. You're not going to fool all the people because, what I told you before, there's more good than evil out there, and all people want is a fair shot.
Yep.
They're not asking everybody to become a millionaire, for God's sake. Give me a chance to raise my family. Give me a chance so my kids have an opportunity for an education and a better job and a better life than I have. That's what our parents did. You know, and that's what we have to continue to fight and forge forward.
And that is the American legacy, that my kids are going to do better than I am. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to play by the rules so that they get the shot that maybe I didn't. And sadly, my kids, you know, the way things are looking, my kids aren't going to do as well as I did.
Well, I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, I have 7 grandkids. I have 4 grown kids. I understand what you're saying. You know, I was fortunate. I worked in one spot for 38 years. Loved doing what I was doing as an educator. Now, you know, there are very few of those jobs where you can say, you know what, you're going to have a job for until you retire.
Yeah.
The statistics say kids now are going to change jobs 3 and 4 times in their lifetime. That's a tough thing to do unless you're moving on up. But don't worry. I have great faith in humanity. I think there's more good than not. And having taught for all those years, there are so many bright kids, just incredibly bright kids that are going to do wonderful things for America.
Yeah, and I got to be honest with you. I wonder how many of those bright kids have been harmed over the last 3 years with this governor's assault on education and all the money that, even though Sue Helms said they stole it and put it back, that hasn't happened. And there are 20,000 education professionals who aren't on the job because of that theft.
Well, Sue is obviously my colleague, and I respect Sue.
Now, I'm not asking you to talk bad about her. Her words spoke for herself.
We didn't put it all back, believe me. If we put it all back, your school districts wouldn't have had to cut classes, wouldn't have had to cut teachers, wouldn't have had to make pay for play, you know, eliminate art and music and library and guidance, et cetera. If they put it all back, the school district wouldn't have that problem. Plus 20,000 teachers and the aides that they have. They got eliminated.
And my 6th grade daughter wouldn't be sitting in a class with 100 kids under the heading of LGI, which I got to be honest, my head is still reeling over. I want to bang through a couple of quick things before I let you go. The minimum wage, this to me another hot topic. Although, you know, back in 2006 here on the program when we were fighting to get it raised, then I said back then we should be indexing it so that it goes up with inflation, so that we don't have to keep doing this every 4, 5, 6, or 7 years as we are now, right back where we started from 7, 8 years later. Are we going to get minimum wage increase this year, or is this something that's going to take a new governor and a new legislature to get passed through?
Well, from the Democratic side, we certainly support the idea of increasing the living wage for all the reasons you said. Wages are stagnant, and all of the cost of living, your food, your clothes, your gas, your utilities, everything else has gone up, which means the working class folks are sinking. Now, whether we'll get it passed or not is another story. But that's one of the interesting things about an election year. And the governor's going to have to figure out whether this will help elect them or not. If it helps elect them, he'll certainly try to push that forward.
Right. Medicaid expansion, does that get passed? Does the governor take the money?
The governor is trying desperately to incorporate his ideas changing the Affordable Care Act. And there's quite a few issues with what he's attempting to do. By the way, right now we're losing about $10 million every day that we did not expand Medicaid right here in Pennsylvania. So he has a hybrid plan that they're now going all over the state, and within 30 days they're going to try to make a decision. And then it's going to take days in order to implement whatever that decision is, but the feds have to approve it.
Right.
And there's various elements of it that I don't see them approving.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So I, I don't know what the outcome of the hybrid plan will be.
No, I mean,
here's what your listeners need to know. And I'm not saying this. I'm talking about Kaiser Foundation and other quality groups that have done this study. We're talking about $3 to $4 billion of federal dollars infused into Pennsylvania every year for 10 years. We're talking about 35,000 jobs. Now, we're talking about living wage jobs that will be created with that money as we expand Medicaid. You should never turn your back on that. The governor is now starting to get the heat on that. That's why he's trying to do his hybrid plan.
Right.
I think that we're going to get some form of Medicaid expansion, to be honest with you.
Well, good. Even if it does mean that he can continue to walk around the state and say that he's the more jobs governor, even if it is only more than Wyoming. Last question I've got for you. The Koch brothers and the wealth class of this country are putting a ton of their money into groups like ALEC, pushing ALEC model legislation. And one of the things I'm hearing whispers of that may pop up is this assault on public workers again. This time making it to where the state won't collect dues and have the dues check off come out of folks' paychecks. Because the only excuse that I'm hearing from those who are pushing this is that it's too expensive, which I got to be honest, I can't imagine in this day and age with the electronic systems that we have that it would be all that expensive, maybe a tenth of a penny at best.
You're 100% right. It is not costly. And if there was a major cost involved, the unions would help balance that cost out. Look, you're right again when you mentioned this is part of ALEC's plan. They want to eliminate collective bargaining. They want to reduce and eliminate unions. And you know why? Because the unions fight for proper working conditions, safe working conditions, a living wage, you know, decent benefits. And the new union mantra for the last decade has they've understood that they're part of the business. So it makes no sense for a union to demand so much that you put that business out of business and they don't have a job. So it's definitely the ALEC model. This is part of their legislation. We have several bills in the hopper right now that have been they're out there going for co-sponsors. The labor guys, the committee guys will know about it. But they're there. That's part of their plan. They're going to try to do it. We just have to try to fight it, and hopefully we'll be successful.
And it's going to take our listeners calling their legislators early and often and saying, hey, we're watching. It's that simple in my view.
You got that right. Eddie, absolutely correct.
Eddie Day, it's always great talk with you. I appreciate you coming and taking time for us.
Thank you for doing what you do. Thank you for your listeners. Spread the word, please. Be ever vigilant. Happy New Year, and wear your gotchies, man. It's cold.
Yeah, it's stay warm, Eddie. Eddie Day Pyszczynski, Pennsylvania State Representative. Thanks so much. Appreciate the time. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-540-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Attention class, here's today's new word, native advertising. Okay, that's two words, but it's one concept, and it has nothing to do with native people. Rather, it's a phrase sprung on us by the wonky wordsmiths of internet media, who also refer to it as, quote, brand content, meaning that these particular web pages are not articles, but paid advertising. But they don't want to be too explicit about distinguishing between genuine news items and ad hustles. Why not? Money, of course. In today's fledgling web publications, from such newbies as BuzzFeed to the digital versions of old-line pubs like the New York Times, there's been a blurring of the line between the publication's legitimate journalistic content and the faux stories that are provided by marketers and designed to look like real articles from non-biased news sources. For readers and viewers, the questions are obvious. Whose stuff is this, and what can I trust? The best ethical response by online publishers would be to draw a bright line around all branded content, perhaps with some flashing neon lights and honking horns to announce, "This is an ad." But no, while internet publishers say they seek journalistic integrity, they're hungrier still for advertisers' dollars, so their game is to flash just enough integrity without losing the bucks. That's a losing game for integrity. Media analyst Bob Garfield notes that the very effectiveness of native advertising depends on it being confused with editorial content. Eliminate the confusion, and the ethical failure diminishes, he says, but what will also diminish to near vanishing point is the readership of those adverts. This is Jim Hightower saying, any media so dependent on corporate money that it resorts to deceiving its audience is, in a word, dependent. Also, untrustworthy. We need public financing to free the independence of journalism on the web.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Joker, you don't want to turn around. Well, okay. He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane.
In fact, our Governor Corbett, took a page out of the Herman Cain Train's playbook. Evidently, they launched Farmers for Corbett. Because it's Farm Show Week, I guess, in Harrisburg, where they've got big cheese and butter sculptures of milkshakes, which you figure out. I can't, but hey, you know, people like big sculptures of butter. Yeah. But launched this Farmers for Corbett thing, but used stock footage of actual farmers. Didn't actually get any Pennsylvania farmers, no. So you got to wonder which farmers are for Corbett. Are they the Canadian farmers that the pictures were of? Just a thought. And, you know, you look at this, and you got to ask the question, you know, who's running this guy's campaign and who's running the state? When most of what this governor has done, and like, look, the business community loves him. Loves him. Because he's given him huge amounts of money. Here, have a boatload of cash. He's not raised taxes on the very well-to-do, the people who could afford it. He's left the Delaware loophole wide open, so all of those corporate profits can go be scrubbed clean there in Delaware and then, you know, divvied up wherever, not here, wherever. And, of course, let's not forget Act 13. Let's not forget wanting to take local control away from local municipalities and saying the state will impose where drillers can stick their needles in your arms, where they can plunge their drill into your land, and, well, who knows what. And then we're not even going to tax it at a rate that would replace the damage being done. Oh, I know, but he's the more jobs governor. Then you look at the numbers that they threw out. And, again, you know, it's all of this Arthur Anderson-type creative accounting. And I love, you know, I love creative accounting. I love creative thinking. But when you've got a governor who says, Marcellus Shale created 200,000 jobs, and then you look and you see a lot of the jobs that he claims were created were in sewer facilities in Philadelphia, where you go, whoa, is there any gas in any of the Marcellus Shale in Philadelphia? Well, no. And you go down the list and you look at the long-haul truck drivers and the freight industry that they claim is jobs created. And then you look at the reality that most of the jobs were created before the guy took office. And at best, maybe you could say, you know, 15 to 20,000 jobs were created in the Marcellus Shale during his time as governor, but that had little to do with him. It had everything to do with the fact that that's where the gas is. So it's to me, kind of interesting. And I got to tell you, this, I know there's a history in Pennsylvania of giving a governor two terms. Honestly and truthfully, I don't believe this guy earned the right to have a second term. Now, the moneyed interests, they're going to be loaded. And they're going to be spending to get this guy reelected. Because, understand, if they can have four more years of absolute ideological one-party rule, what will Pennsylvania look like in the end of four more years under Corbett and the Republicans? Will we be the next South Carolina, Mississippi, or Alabama with extremely high unemployment rates, extremely high poverty rates, with extremely high child poverty rates, and uninsured? Will we have all of those problems that ideological states like that? South Carolina? Is that what we want to look like? And I look at this, the number of priorities that I think we should be going after. Pushing the minimum wage. Pushing for Medicaid expansion to make sure that people make a decent living, can get health care when they need it. I look at all the assets that they want to hawk off. I mean, is anybody happy? Anyone thrilled that we spent millions of dollars of taxpayer money to hand our lottery off to a foreign for-profit corporation? Is anybody thrilled with that? I mean, because I would love to hear someone say, well, you know, Rick, it's a good thing. I was listening to one of those 6 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning shows this past weekend, and they had Lisa Boscola, the Democrat from Allentown, and I forget the Republican guy's name off the top of my head, a House member. And they were both talking about privatizing the lottery as if, you know, hey, well, it might be a good thing. We're going to continue to look into it. And basically reading off the same playbook, and I'm going, wait a second. I listened to the testimony. I sat there and listened to the hearings that said the way that it is being managed and run right now is better than anywhere in the country. And, in fact, the company that wanted to take over the lottery and run it had cited Pennsylvania's running of the lottery as the way to do it and the way that they would emulate. And you could go down through a whole lot of different arguments that came up out of those hearings. At the end of it, what this company believed that they were going to do is flood our state with lottery. Not without your input whatsoever. They were just going to do it. There would be games everywhere. And they were going to take a new game, Keno, and put that everywhere. Now, I said at the very beginning of it, if we're going to allow them to do it, why can't we do it for ourselves and pocket the money that we would have earned, and hey, help seniors and help where we need to. So I look at this, and you know, all of these privatization schemes are just a dead bang ripoff. And I look at, you know, some of the ALEC legislation jumping around. My favorite one being Seth Groves, the Republican Seth Groves piece of legislation that would make it illegal for my local township to pass an ordinance that says, you know what, if you're going to employ people, you should have at least a paid sick day or two in case you get sick. They would make it illegal. Illegal. Now, these are the people who tell us that they believe in small, local government, less intrusive government. Now, understand, in areas that have passed these paid sick day ordinances, it's actually benefited not only the workers, but the businesses as well. In fact, a couple of researchers, Eileen Applebaum and Ruth Milkman, they did a study, they conducted a study in Connecticut and looked at the effects of 2 years of, you know, 2 years ago, Connecticut passed a law that said, you know, we're going to have to give some paid sick days. It's been in effect for 2 years, and they took a look at it, and what they found, a few of the businesses in Connecticut had any significant cost increases. They just did it. Only 10% reported that they had an increase in their payroll cost by more than 3%, only 10%. And you go, well, what did it do for their retention? Retention was better. Morale was better. And I look at this and I go, so much of what our government should be doing, it's not. And so much of what it shouldn't be doing, it is. I'm a firm believer in our government setting the floor, saying, look, if you're going to have a federal poverty line, no one who works should fall below that poverty line. No one. And you should have policies that push that. In fact, I got to be honest with you. The federal poverty line is pathetic because I don't know how anyone exists on, even if you were making right at the poverty line or a dollar over, because now you're not in poverty, right? I don't get it. And I look at all of the things that we should be doing and we're not. Because the moneyed interest, the Kochs and the Diane Hendricks and the Arthur Popes and all of these people who have just, you know, I get people who say, well, you're just, you're envious of rich people. No, these are not rich people. You know, these are extraordinarily wealthy people. And you go, what's the difference? Well, there's a huge difference. And someone explained it to me very, very eloquently and very simply. Shaquille O'Neal's rich. The guy who wrote his check is wealthy. Because Shaquille O'Neal, as rich as he may be, he still works for a living. He's still got to go punch a clock. He's still got to go do work. The people who write that check and pull his strings, those are the folks who are running this country. And all of our policy decisions, all of the push towards whatever direction we go is to appease them. And to me, their greed has gotten out of hand. Their insatiable appetite for more knows no bounds. You know, you could argue that, you know, after World War II, the wealth class, the robber barons of that era, you know, felt a little bit ashamed and were shamed into saying, okay, well, we should, you know, maybe a little bit. We'll loosen the purse strings a little bit. Not now, man. Our billionaire class today grabs a quarter and the eagle's screaming. But they have no problem spending that quarter to get someone like Corbett elected. They have no problem spending that money pushing legislation, the ALEC model legislation. And why? Because they understand return on investment. They understand that if they can screw those union workers, or if they can make it illegal for a local municipality to pass sick days, or if they can make sure that a minimum wage increase doesn't happen, that means more for them. It's that simple. So when you go back and you look at Papa Jannies, who, if you remember the election last year, or in 2012, if you remember the election in 2012, he came out against the Affordable Care Act saying, well, you know, if the Affordable Care Act goes into effect, I'm going to cut my employees under 30 hours a week so I don't have to pay it. No, he got tons of blowback. And in fact, so much so that he had to write an op-ed piece saying that, well, he was never really going to do that. He was just kind of speculating what he might do. What someone, not what he might do, what someone might do. Now, according to this branding site, YouGov Brand Index, they claim, now they're one of the leading market survey companies across the country. They do this marketplace branding or the buzz or however you want to put it, and they looked at Papa Jannies, Papa John's for those of you who don't know. They looked at Papa John's brand identity. And at one point, they had, before this idiotic comment, their branding was about 32, which is extremely high. Evidently now, it has fallen to 4 because of these comments. Applebee's, another one. Before some of the comments that their CEO made, their buzz score, according to the folks at YouGov Brand Index, was 35, down to 5. Because he said, well, if the Affordable Care Act were to go into place, we wouldn't build any more restaurants, and we wouldn't hire any more workers, and, of course, we would cut their hours down to basically nothing. Now, is that going to happen? I don't know. This year is going to be very interesting to see what happens with the Affordable Care Act. This year is going to be very interesting to see if Papa John's and the Darden restaurants, the Olive Gardens and the Red Lobsters, and all of those people who made so much noise and said, we're going to stick it to our workers. And I said at the time, I hope they do, because maybe it shakes us awake. Maybe it says, hey, these people don't care about you. You're a tool. You're nothing more than a screwdriver or a hammer in their mind. Can be discarded and replaced. And the sad reality is we've allowed that to happen. Now, I hear people go, well, you know, Rick, my company's not like that. I had this interesting conversation over the weekend because I had a guy, and I love my weekend gig because it gives me a great opportunity to talk about things that you don't really get a lot of face-to-face contact over. Guy goes, you don't really think that unions are needed today? And I said, I absolutely do, more than ever. And he said, well, I don't. I go, whoa, stop for a second. Weren't you the guy who is just standing here complaining about the equipment that you're driving and how it doesn't have heat and how... it's old and it's a rattle trap, and that the hours you're working are incredibly long, and you don't get break time, and the wages are horrible, and the benefits are horrible, and the boss treats you like, aren't you the one who was just telling me all of those things? Well, yeah. I say, well, that's the reason that you organize. That's the reason that you get a voice on the job, because you can't stand up to your boss and say, well, I don't like the fact that you're treating me horrible or my wages are horrible. And there was a moment where he just kind of stood there and thought about it, as if never before had the thought ever entered into his mind that he could do something about his condition, that he could do something about his situation. And I got to be honest, I'm amazed. And I guess it's because I've always had a union job. I guess it's always because I've had that. And I'm looking at it now as a luxury, that when the brakes are out of alignment, I would go to the boss and say, hey, I'm not taking that. You got to fix it. I'm not driving on the road endangering someone else, let alone myself. Now I'm looking at that as a luxury for most people who have never had it. And to me, this is what the wealth class is extremely afraid of. They're afraid of a bunch of people who all of a sudden realize that they have a voice, that they have some say. And if you give them that on the job, they're going to take it into society. And they're going to end up like my grandfather. They're going to end up like his generation, who fought for better wages, hours, and conditions, yes, but also better education, better health care, better infrastructure, a better society, a better future for their kids. That's what they fear. Let's take a quick break. Right back with hour two of the program. If you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Right back. Stick around.
Values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's really a corporate extortion plan by Boeing trying to make aerospace a race to the bottom. 7,000 to 8,000 members didn't vote on it, and it was such a slim margin. 300 votes either way would have changed it. That means about 37.5% of the members actually got to decide the fate for the next 10 years, which erases 78 years of collective bargaining history.
International Association. to Machinists District 751 spokesperson Connie Kelleher. Many IAM District 751 Boeing machinists are very angry about the vote forced on them by their international union that destroyed defined benefit pensions, increased health care costs, and diminished wages. Some members have filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board and are demanding a revote when a true majority of IAM Boeing members would have a chance to cast ballots. Kelleher says that due to members being away on holidays vacation, about 25% of members didn't vote on this concessionary contract proposal.
Members are very upset. There's been a huge outcry since Friday's vote was announced from members calling for a revote. Our international president forced this vote under the guise of he wanted the members to have the final say on it. Well, if you want the members to have the final say, don't pick a day where you know 25 to 30% of them are not available. A lot of people are very upset and have gone to the NLRB. They are passing around petitions that they want to call for a revote when truly a majority of the members could determine the fate. Our international president has said all along that he responds to hearing from the members, so right now the members are busy speaking up and letting him hear them.
Kelleher says the contract Boeing forced on workers under threat of moving the production of the 777X airliner was corporate extortion that squeezed both the workers and $8.7 billion in tax concessions from Washington State. And she says despite this being portrayed as giving up pensions and other concessions in return for guaranteed jobs, there is no real ironclad jobs guarantee for future Washington State union jobs from Boeing in this contract.
For a two-paragraph language giving us the airplane, the first sentence says we get the work and the next two paragraphs give them loopholes to move it. It not only gave up the defined benefit pension, it destroyed the health care, really. The premiums will go up 300% by the end, copays will double, all policies drop to 90% coverage on everything. In addition, wage growth is cut by 75% from the current contract, which was only a 2% wage increase each year. It'll now be 1% every other year, and then it'll go 3 years.
Meanwhile, Boeing is making record profits. The CEO got a 20% raise last year, and he has a pension that will pay him $265,000 a month when he retires, and a supplemental pension on top of that. IAM International President Tom Buffenbarger was not available for an interview, but the International says the $8.7 billion in legislative incentives in Washington State are contingent on Boeing remaining in Puget Sound.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The way to meet the challenge of energy and global climate change is through technology. And the United States is in the lead. The world is on the verge of great breakthroughs that will help us become better stewards of the environment.
I hope you're riding the storm out in a place that is warm. I got to be honest with you, it is really, really very cold out. And for all of those public servants who are out on the roads, making sure that the ice hasn't built up. If you're out there riding one of the trucks, or you're out there a cop or a firefighter out there rescuing people and doing your job, thank you for being out there. It is brutal. Anyway, our quote of the day comes from Pennsylvania Republican Party Chairman Rob Gleason on the news that Jim Gerlach, the U.S. Republican U.S. representative, announced his retirement after six terms, citing a partisan gridlock and the long commute. Gleason said that Gerlach could probably find a job on K Street after being a lobbyist for 12 years. He said it's a tough job, Gleason did, of Gerlach. It's a tough job. You don't make a lot of money. They don't make a lot of money. Sad reality is Congress makes about $174,000 a year, which is nearly 3.5 times the median household income for average everyday work folks like you and me. But, you know, hey, that's the world our the chairman there lives in. Anyway, let's find out what's going on here in Pennsylvania. Hey, last year they got the transportation bill, maybe some work on the horizon. I've got Abe Amaros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for LIUNA, on the line. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, you're welcome, Rick. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. Did you have a good holiday season?
Yes, I did, and I hope you and your family did also, my
friend. It was a lot warmer where I was for the holiday.
Good. Where were you?
We went down to Hollywood, Florida for 2 weeks to sit on the beach and just veg.
Fantastic.
The kids had a ball jumping in and out of the ocean, and we come back to this.
Yes.
Like, you know, what made us come back? We should have stayed.
Absolutely brutal out there. And I echo what your sentiments in terms of all the public officials out there and the public servants who are trying to make our roads safer and, of course, trying to do all the best that they can to help us with this Arctic freeze.
You know,
so I echo your statement.
You know, no, look, I was out on Sunday, you know, because every weekend I take a road trip. I work, I drive a truck on the weekends for, you know, just because I enjoy it, an extra couple of bucks. And Sunday was, you know, brutal. I mean, it was freezing rain all day Sunday, and you saw these guys out there in the trucks, and you saw these guys out there trying to rescue people who, you know, would go driving, blowing by me at 70 miles an hour on the ice, and you'd go, oh, I'll see you down the road. And there they were, flipped over on the side of their car. And there were the police, and there were the rescue people helping these folks, putting their lives in danger because they were being idiotic.
That's right, yeah. It's a sad thing.
Sad, sad stuff. So what do you think of this comment by Chairman Gleason? That, you know, it's a tough job. They don't make a lot of money.
Oh, Rick. I mean, you nailed it right there, brother. Listen, they make 3.5 times of median income households in Pennsylvania, and he's complaining? Holy smokes. $174,000 is nothing to scoff at. In fact, $174,000, that's more than the governor makes in Pennsylvania. And you're talking about a position where you have to run every 2 years. I understand that, you know, you got to run every 2 years. You got to spend most of your time raising money. But you know what? That's part of the job. So it's laughable to me that the chairman of the Republican Party, who's completely out of touch and has been there way too long, is talking about Gerlach leaving, and it's really not that much money. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me, and it's an insult to every working person in America, quite frankly. And I understand that that seat is going to be a hotly contested race because while Gerlach has been a moderate Republican, those that are lining up are not exactly moderate Republicans, except for one, who is John Rafferty, Senator John Rafferty, who coincidentally was the fella that pushed the transportation bill as hard as he could in the Senate. And, of course, getting back to one of your topics, there is a transportation for this year. And, of course, these contracts are going to start letting them out pretty soon, Rick. And you're going to see some people going back to work in the construction field as early as the spring. And that is good. And I'm hoping that, we keep the momentum going on these projects and that a lot of people are going to come out of that misery because, hey, man, it was a rough holiday season for a lot of people. Yeah,
I know some people who are construction workers, and they, for the last couple of years, struggling. I mean, you know, just trying to make ends meet, hoping that jobs come up. And you go back to the governor and this. Granted, they got something done. I don't think it's near enough, but it's something. But it took way too long, in my view.
You are right on both counts. First of all, it took way too long. I mean, this is something that should have been done in the first 6 months of this governor's term, and it didn't happen that way. And secondly, you're right again, it's not enough, Rick. I mean, even the governor's Transportation Advisory Commission report said that you needed to start with $3.5 billion.
Yep.
And this was 2 years ago. I mean, this was in 2012. So, I mean, imagine what it's costing now. At $1 million a day, you could have added $365 million at least to that bottom line. Now, I know that, you know, people should be happy with the $2.3, $2.5 billion that's being banded around. But at the same time, like you said, it wasn't enough. We really needed about $5 billion, Rick, to be honest with you. But I'm hoping that all these jobs are going to translate into good things for many communities in Pennsylvania and our workers who have been hurting.
Yeah, and that's the important thing, getting folks back to work. And so, because you know, on the federal level, we're, you know, they're debating. We're finally passed through the Senate the unemployment extension, the emergency extension. To me, the best way to fix that problem is to get people back to work.
Exactly right.
Simple stuff. But you know, I wanted to get your thoughts what the new year is going to hold, with it being the beginning of the year. I'm hearing a lot of whispers of the Koch brothers and their folks spending a lot of money on pushing ALEC legislation. And I just wanted to get a feel of how you see the next couple of months here of the new year going on the legislature. I know you're keenly aware of the goings-on, and I wanted to get your opinion on some of the attacks that you see coming.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are going to be many more attacks. In fact, there have been several pieces of legislation that have already been aimed at attacking prevailing wage once again. I mean, these guys just don't go away. And there were 15 Republicans, Rick, who voted against the transportation bill because they felt that raising the threshold didn't go far enough. I mean, raising it to $100,000 wasn't far enough for them. And there was a flurry of co-sponsorship memos in December that floated throughout Harrisburg looking for sponsors to raise it again and also introduce right-to-work legislation. Now, being that it's an election year, a lot of pundits and a lot of folks are going to say, oh, it's harmless, they're just doing this to rouse up votes back home. But you know what? I get paid to be nervous when there's nothing to be nervous about. And this makes me awfully nervous because you still have a core group of legislators in the House who want to see working families get stiffed even more.
Right.
And, you know, we can't have this. We simply can't have it. It's a big year in terms of the governor's race. And, I mean, we got to keep our eye on the legislature as well, Rick. And interestingly enough, I'm sure that you and your listeners know about what the speaker did in terms of putting forth legislation to actually shrink the legislature, to have fewer representatives and fewer senators in Harrisburg. And, of course, that would take two votes in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and then it would have to go to a referendum to the voters. If it gets as far as the voters, I'm certain that many people will agree that we have a bloated, outdated General Assembly, so to speak. And, you know, if you get, when you work around these guys as much as I do, Rick, I mean, there's some truth to it. There are a lot of guys that, and gals come to Harrisburg, they punch their clock and they go back home, they put out the free newsletters, and they don't really get a whole lot done. There's not a whole lot of heavy lifting done. So we have to keep them all accountable, especially in 2014.
Yeah, I'm with you. But, you know, here's the thing. I'm, and I don't know where you stand on this, but I'm not in favor of shrinking the legislature too much or at all because, you know, I have this very simple view that the wealth of this country, they don't want to keep spending all this money on politics. And it would be so much easier to buy a smaller legislature than it would a larger one that was more accountable to the people. I think we should have a larger Congress. I think we should have a larger legislature so that, that these folks are closer and more accountable, in my view.
That's right, Rick. I mean, you make a very good point. And getting back to your earlier reference to the Koch brothers, those guys aren't going away. They've quieted down just a little bit because they're not exactly popular. But they're not going anywhere in terms of, I mean, look, they're you keep amassing their millions on a monthly basis, and they keep funding these horrific groups that do their bidding. They're not going away. They are not going away. So shrinking the legislature is going to allow them to buy more people for even less money. And that's not the way representative government should work, actually.
No, I'm with you.
Unfortunately, it does in our system, you know. But what we got to do is we got to get our guys and gals fired up enough to run for these offices if they are fed up with the status quo. And you're going to see a lot of working people. For instance, there's a fellow by the name of John Kane who is running for an open seat in the state Senate. He is a business manager for the Plumbers Union out in the greater Philadelphia area. I mean, we have to get more working people involved in the process, more people putting out those petitions to get on ballots starting in February, and the petitions begin on February the 11th, which is a Tuesday, and end on the 24th, which is a Monday. So what we have to do, really, is encourage our working people to get involved in the political system as candidates or as people who work on these campaigns, Rick, because working people voices, I mean, our voices are not being heard at the level they should be.
I'm with you. But, you know, what do you say to the person who, you know, because I've actually kicked it around a couple of times of running against the state representative, Stephen Bloom, who I think is just toxic on so many levels. And just destructive. His viewpoint on working people, to me, just very destructive. But you know, you're never going to compete, and maybe you think I'm wrong, with the moneyed interests that back him. And you know, the fact of the matter is most of the people I know, they're struggling to make ends meet like everybody else.
They really are. And you hit the nail on the head with Bloom. I mean, I have debated him on several occasions at public hearings and on PCN because I think he's absolutely dead wrong on all of our issues. And if it were up to him, they'd completely eliminate prevailing wage. If it were up to him, we'd have right-to-work legislation. But here's the interesting thing, Rick. The numbers are skewed. There's no doubt about it, because he lives in a very safe district. But if we don't have candidates running against him, I mean, we're never going to have a shot. And like Wayne Gretzky said, you know, you miss every shot you don't take. So we have to have people on the ballot, and we have to let people know that we're watching them. And here's the other interesting thing. Some of these guys and gals in those Republican districts, Rick, have been so dormant that they have not even raised money for their own coffers. They skate because you don't have a lot of strong, organized opposition in place. You don't have very active Democratic committees in some of those areas. So people throw up their hands right away before the ball game even begins. And I'm saying you got to play every game, every quarter, and you got to make sure that you hold these guys accountable, because you may get surprised sometimes. I mean, you have to debate them. You have to raise money. You have to do grassroots. Because campaigns are about two things, organized people and organized money.
Right.
And so we're always going to get outspent. But I, you know, I have not looked at Mr. Bloom's expenses or finances, but I easily could. And I'll bet he doesn't have as much in there as one might think, given the fact that he has skated for so long. And the Republican Party and their minions, they've been putting their millions of dollars in other hotly contested races rather than the one here. It's just something to think about, obviously. But we can't give these guys a free pass, Rick. We really can't.
I'm with you. Do you think there's a chance? I mean, I've been saying for a while, if Corbett's reelected and the Republicans maintain the majorities that they have now, Pennsylvania is basically going to be like South Carolina.
I agree with you, because they're going to get their moxie up. And if we give this guy a second term, he's just going to get extraordinarily bold, and his people are going to get stronger, and you're going to have a legislature that's just not going to care what working families, working people think about. They're going to ram every bad piece of legislation through that legislature here in Harrisburg, and we're going to be in some real trouble. So that's why we have to do the heavy lifting in 2014, so we don't have that kind of scenario. If everything works to our advantage, we will have a Democratic governor in 2015. We will have a competitive, even more competitive state Senate than we have right now. I mean, it's 27-23, but if we get lucky, we could get 26-24. And, of course, in the House, I mean, we're probably not going to get the majority, but, I mean, we're looking at picking up four seats if everything goes well. And, of course, it's early on in January, Rick. That's why we have to do the work now.
Yep.
To make sure that we have a chance in the fall.
And to keep people on focused in the right direction. I look at this governor, and the governor's mansion, I think, is really one that can easily be flipped, because his record is so bad. I mean,
yeah.
He's running around saying he's the more jobs governor, but, you know, more jobs in Wyoming, that ain't going to sell.
It's not going to sell, Rick. And, of course, he's still in the tank in terms of popularity. I mean, I saw a Quinnipiac poll that came out on December the 18th, just a few weeks ago, that showed five out of the eight announced Democratic candidates winning. And one unannounced candidate by the name of Jack Wagner, who was a former auditor general, who has yet to announce his candidacy, but probably will by the end of January, I mean, he was beating him by 12 points. He was in the lead, and he's the unannounced candidate. So that's really bad news for Tom Corbett, seeing that the Quinnipiac poll is one of the best and
right.
most respected polls in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, he's in real trouble. And if we lose this thing, we only have ourselves to blame. That's why I'm urging listeners to really pay attention to this race and really back the winner of the Democratic primary, because that's the only chance we're going to have to change this.
I'm with you. Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, these next couple of months, this right when the legislature gets back, I think this is the most dangerous period because we're furthest away from the election cycle. What do you see as being the most egregious, the worst pieces of legislation that may come up?
Yes. In fact, I talked about them earlier. I think that they're going to push anti-prevailing wage legislation. They're going to try to push right-to-work legislation, but keep an eye on the privatization of the state stores. I know I've seen stories in the last 2 weeks that the movement has fizzled out just a little bit because the governor threw up his hands as it related to the privatizing of the lottery. But the privatization of the state store system is still alive and well as pension reform. They want to give public employees less for more work, and, of course, that's unfair. So, I mean, keep an eye on those two big pieces of legislation. You're going to have an anti-worker agenda. And just like you said, this is the silly season, quite frankly, because very few people are paying attention to what's happening. I mean, they're only going to be around for 3 days, Rick, next week, the 13th, 14th, and 15th in session. February is going to be a light month, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th, because of budget hearings. But you're going to see a lot of mischief during those budget hearings, because while people are paying attention to the talking heads in front of those committees, that's where the staff is going to be churning up all this garbage and teeing it up before the primary in May. So you're looking at heavy sessions in April and in May before the budget season really starts to churn in June. So this is the time to keep an eye on all the bad stuff that can happen.
Yeah, and begin to mobilize.
Exactly.
That's the end of it. Abe, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time. Look forward to having you back again.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for LIUNA. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? Ask Me members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Attention class, here's today's new word, native advertising. Okay, that's two words, but it's one concept, and it has nothing to do with native people. Rather, it's a phrase sprung on us by the wonky wordsmiths of internet media, who also refer to it as, quote, brand content, meaning that these particular web pages are not articles, but paid advertising. But they don't want to be too explicit about distinguishing between genuine news items and ad hustles. Why not? Money, of course. In today's fledgling web publications, from such newbies as BuzzFeed to the digital versions of old-line pubs like the New York Times, there's been a blurring of the line between the publication's legitimate journalistic content and the faux stories that are provided by marketers and designed to look like real articles from non-biased news sources. For readers and viewers, the questions are obvious. Whose stuff is this, and what can I trust? The best ethical response by online publishers would be to draw a bright line around all branded content, perhaps with some flashing neon lights and honking horns to announce, this is an ad. But no, while internet publishers say they seek journalistic integrity, they're hungrier still for advertisers' dollars, so their game is to flash just enough integrity without losing the bucks. That's a losing game for integrity. Media analyst Bob Garfield notes that the very effectiveness of native advertising depends on it being confused with editorial content. Eliminate the confusion, and the ethical failure diminishes, he says, but what will also diminish to near vanishing point is the readership of those adverts. This is Jim Hightower saying, any media so dependent on corporate money that it resorts to deceiving its audience is, in a word, dependent. Also, untrustworthy. We need public financing to free the independence of journalism on the web.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There was a controversial remark made by a member of your legal team comparing gay marriage to the union of 12-year-olds, saying both are illegal, which you called inappropriate.
It was an inappropriate analogy. You know, I think a much better analogy would have been brother and sister, don't you?
I don't know.
Well, we
I don't know.
There are days where I wonder what my reaction would have been had I sat and listened to him say that. I mean, really, how can you hear that and not just go, what are you talking about? Wow. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So today, back in 1892 in Oklahoma, in Krebs, Oklahoma, A massive mine explosion killed nearly 100 people, injuring 150 more. Because, well, as History.com put it, the company, the mine owner, had an emphasis of profit over safety. And the land, most of the land that they were mining, belonged to Native Americans, which was exempt from U.S. laws and regulations. What few laws and regulations they had back in 1892, exempt. So this, you know, this number 11 mine was notorious for horrible conditions. Had an amazingly high turnover rate. The company, you routinely hired people who didn't know what they were doing. So when these poorly trained people were down in the mine, handling explosives, handling munitions, well, on this day, boom. 100 miners were burned and buried in the explosion. 150 more suffered massive injuries. And it wasn't until 2002 that the victims of the disaster were honored by a memorial built on the old mine site. Think about that. Did anyone go to jail then? No. And you go, oh, but Rick, you know, that was 1892. That was so long ago. That stuff doesn't happen today. Well, according to the Department of Labor, 2013 saw a 42% increase. Saw an increase in the number of miners killed here in the U.S. 42 miners were killed last year, up from 36 the year before. And what did they come up with? What was the reason? Well, here's the reality. These mine disasters are preventable. These deaths are preventable. Sad reality is what you've got is you've got a starve the beast kind of mentality against government regulations. So you don't have the mine inspectors, and what you end up having is you have people cutting corners. Safety precautions that could prevent the deaths of these miners are lacking. And I had just, you know, I just read a book while I was on vacation. And it, you know, I had actually interviewed the author not too long before, a guy named Napoleon Gomez. He was the president of the Mine Workers Union in Mexico. Actually, in exile in Canada, because he was fighting to make mines safer. There was a horrible tragedy. There were some 65 miners were buried, killed, and buried alive. And he made a very cogent argument that you look in, and remember the disaster in Chile, where we were watching on TV as they were pulling these miners out of the ground who had survived underground for, I think it was like 69 days or something like that. And the technology that came in and all the resource that came into saving these miners was done in a place like Chile. Well, in Mexico, not so much. So he was saying, look, this is industrial murder. This is industrial homicide. And the Mexican government, in bed with these big corporations, threatened his family, threatened his life, threatened to throw him in jail, used the power of government against the workers. And this is, you know, I keep going back to this. Folks, safety regulations are in place for a reason, and that's to protect you and me, the working people. And you might think that, oh, well, we're so much better than that. We're not. You know, you look at the Upper Big Branch mine that killed 29 people a couple years back. You look at in Colorado, where two workers died just back in November, at a mine that has an accident rate twice the national average that we still, you know, don't inspect all that often. I guess it was inspected, in 2013, sometime after this, but they had 11 citations. They paid $4,000 in fines. So let me ask you a question. If you're the mentality that it's profit over people, we don't care about the conditions. If someone dies on the job, we'll pay the $3,000 or $4,000 fine and be done with it. And we can get the next piece of machinery to come in and do the job. Are you going to rectify and make things right? No, it's a cost of doing business. So that family that lost the breadwinner, that family that lost the parent, the father, the rock of the family, gone. That's not our problem. We'll pay the couple of thousands cost of doing business. And look, the reality is, you know, we've talked about this before. The funding level for these, for OSHA and MSHA, pathetic. In fact, you know, I saw one thing that said for OSHA to inspect every workplace in this country would take 111 years. In this country, 13 people go to work every day and they don't come home. 13 people. Could you be one of them? You know, we were in West Texas, where 14 people lost their lives because a fertilizer plant exploded. Hadn't been inspected since 1985. But we're told, Rick, we don't need regulation. We don't need OSHA. We don't need any of that. In fact, just in Philadelphia, not too long ago, we talked about this not too long ago. You had an employer said, this is a dangerous job. We're not letting OSHA in. We got to take it back, folks. Got to take it back. Let's take a quick break. We come back and talk a little bit about the unemployment push that happened today. And the Senate got 60 votes. I personally was surprised. But we're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's really a corporate extortion plan by Boeing trying to make aerospace a race to the bottom. 7,000 to 8,000 members didn't vote on it, and it was such a slim margin. 300 votes either way would have changed it. That means about 37.5% of the members actually got to decide the fate for the next 10 years, which erases 78 years of collective bargaining history.
International Association of Machinists, District 751 spokesperson Connie Kelleher. Many IAM District 751 Boeing machinists are very angry about the vote forced on them by their international union that destroyed defined benefit pensions, increased health care costs, and diminished wages. Some members have filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board and are demanding a revote when a true majority of IAM Boeing members would have a chance to cast ballots. Kelleher says that due to members being away on holidays vacation, about 25% of members didn't vote on this concessionary contract proposal.
Members are very upset. There's been a huge outcry since Friday's vote was announced from members calling for a revote. Our international president forced this vote under the guise of he wanted the members to have the final say on it. Well, if you want the members to have the final say, don't pick a day where you know 25 to 30% of them are not available. A lot of people are very upset and have gone to the NLRB. They are passing around petitions that they want to call for a revote when truly a majority of the members could determine the fate. Our international president has said all along that he responds to hearing from the members, so right now the members are busy speaking up and letting him hear them.
Kelleher says the contract Boeing forced on workers under threat of moving the production of the 777X airliner was corporate extortion that squeezed both the workers and $8.7 billion in tax concessions from Washington State. And she says despite this being portrayed as giving up pensions and other concessions in return for guaranteed jobs, there is no real ironclad jobs guarantee for future Washington State union jobs from Boeing in this contract.
For a two-paragraph language giving us the airplane. The first sentence says we get the work, and the next two paragraphs give them loopholes to move it. It not only gave up the defined benefit pension, it destroyed the health care, really. The premiums will go up 300% by the end. Copays will double. All policies drop to 90% coverage on everything. In addition, wage growth is cut by 75% from the current contract, which was only a 2% wage increase each year. It'll now be 1% every other year, and then it'll go 3 years.
Meanwhile, Boeing is making record profits. The CEO got a 20% raise last year, and he has a pension that will pay him $265,000 a month when he retires, and the supplemental pension on top of that. IAM International President Tom Buffenbarger was not available for an interview, but the International says the $8.7 billion in legislative incentives in Washington State are contingent on Boeing remaining in Puget Sound.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So today it looks like the unemployment extension may have another step closer to getting passed in the Senate as the magical 60 number was met in the Senate. But that didn't stop Mitch McConnell from taking the opportunity to say, well, you know, we'd be willing for 3 months to extend the unemployment to those folks who have been so long-term unemployed, but we got to take a year off from Obamacare. And I go, you know, the very people who would need it the most are the exact same people we're talking about who need the unemployment extension. But I guess, you know, give with one hand, taketh with the other. Anyway, here to talk a little bit about this and why unemployment extensions are so important, I've asked Liz Rose, Communication Director over at the Economic Policy Institute, EPI, to come talk to us. Liz, thanks for taking time for us.
So much for having me. I love being on your show.
It's always great having you here, always such great information. And I look at this, and, you know, this 60 vote, this it looks like possible, yes, no?
You know, today the Senate did vote the right way. They voted to give people back, people who need it, back their unemployment insurance benefits. So, you know, it certainly isn't law yet, right? It would have to pass the House and the president would have to sign it. But the Senate made some progress today, and I think it's terrific. You know, the main point that I want people to understand about unemployment insurance is there are right now in the United States not enough jobs. So for every person who's looking for a job, let's say there's three people looking for a job, there's one opening, right? So for every, you know, the number is 2.9 people, but I know it's hard to figure out what is the 0.9% of a person. I'll have my economist explain it to you. But for every one job seeker, there's a third of a job, right? That's the way to think about it. So there just are not enough jobs right now. And that's why people need unemployment insurance. It's not, you know, it's not supposed to be a handout. It's supposed to be temporary so that we can get the economy going again. And then once the economy's going, then there'll be enough jobs. That's the idea of unemployment insurance. And it's still really needed because I'm sure you know people, I know people who've been looking for work for 2 years. And I know a lot of other people who are discouraged, who aren't even counted in the general unemployment numbers anymore because they've sort of quit looking. But when the economy gets better, they'll start looking again.
Right. You know, but I look at this, and you know, this whole fight over a three-month extension, and you go, okay, in 3 months we're going to have to fight this all over again. Why don't we fix the problem? And I've always been an advocate of full employment policies. We go back to the way things used to be, where government was encouraging employment. And if you couldn't find, maybe government being the employer of last resort at some point saying, you know what, we got to get people back to work. We've got to hone their skills, something. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important issue because I think that there's a great dignity in work. And most people want to work, right? If there are jobs out there, you know, people really want to make a paycheck. It makes them feel good. It makes them support their family. On top of it, our society has things that we need. We need roads. We need bridges. We need the broadband to be improved. We need good schools. You know, we need cops and teachers and firefighters. And so it is crazy that, you know, when we have needs and Americans need to work, that we can't, you know, full employment would just make so much sense.
Yeah. So what do you say to the person who says, well, you know, it's been 99 weeks or it's been, you know, 50 weeks or whatever it is. You're just not trying hard enough. Because I hear these things all the time. Here in our state, and I'm sure you may not have heard it, maybe you have, our governor, when he was running for election, said, well, they're just lazy. They just won't go. There are jobs out there. I've seen them, and they just won't go for them. And then he's kind of changed that to they're drug addicts and, you know, all this other stuff.
Right.
He passed a drug test and all that. And I think there are people who it's an easy lift. It sounds, well, you know, it must be. I look at this and I go, you know, I know people who they're struggling. When you see a Walmart open up in Cleveland like a couple years ago did, and for 300 jobs, you've got 5,000 people who show up.
Right, and that the numbers bear that out. I mean, the truth is, there, you know, the government actually counts this stuff. There's a fancy name for it. It's called JOLTS, right? It, you know, we look at these numbers, and you can go on EPI's website and look at it. And there are not enough jobs for job seekers. So people who want jobs, there are not enough jobs open. I mean, that's, you know, that's a fact. The other thing that factors in is sort of a combination of, you know, group psychology and, you know, habit, where employers don't want to look at people who are unemployed. There's a noted bias against right. people who are unemployed. So it's a really heavy lift once you've lost your job to get a new job. It's easier if you have a job to get a new job. And so that skews the numbers. The other groups that are really suffering here are, you know, kids getting out of high school and college. Their unemployment rate is much lower than it should be. Or much
higher.
Higher than it should be, sorry. Yeah. Much higher than it should be. And then, you know, people over a certain age, you know, there's people who are sort of forced into an early retirement but haven't saved enough for that retirement.
Yeah, in fact, I just talked about, you know, the Sloan Center at Boston College just came out with a statistic that like 54% of the people 50 and over who were retired felt that they were forced into retirement for basically what you just said, that there wasn't an alternative, that, you know, they were able to retire. They didn't want to, but they had to because they had no other choice.
Yeah, and most people haven't saved enough, in part because, you know, it used to be companies offered pensions. Most people don't have pensions anymore. So, you know, Social Security was never meant to be a full retirement program. It's supposed to be more of a, you know, a safety net program where you would save and have Social Security. So, you know, people need to work, you know, through retirement age in order to save enough to retire.
Yeah. In fact, you know, just yesterday I was talking about on day one, there were 199 people here in our country who they've paid in every penny they're going to pay into Social Security on the first day of the year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Social Security is a whole other topic. It's the best government program that we have, right? Social Security works really well. Yep. Something that, you know,
the best anti-poverty program we've come up with. But you know, the thing is you go back to this unemployment, and it's so easy to demonize. It's so easy for our politicians, you know, especially here on the state level, to point fingers. And in this debate, you know, as you've been watching what's going on in Washington, do you see that same kind of demonization on the federal level that we see on the state levels?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, you do. I think that, you know, there are a lot of, you know, attempts to be the Republicans who are going around making it look like people are lazy. And you know, there's, I think Fox News or one of the conservative outlets had, you know, they found one surfer who was on unemployment and wasn't really looking for a job and taking his benefits. You know, I think it's easy to find examples of people not looking for work. But most people are really looking very hard for work. They try everything. You know, a lot of people have gone back to school. You know, unfortunately, even having a degree has not protected people. You know, there are a lot of college graduates who do not have jobs. And so, I mean, I think it's something that it's easy to demonize people, but if you've ever been unemployed, it's a really difficult situation. And I also think, you know, it's difficult to survive when you're unemployed. So, you know, what if your cable service gets cut off? What if you don't have internet? What if you can't afford to fix your computer? It gets harder and harder to get a job if you don't have resources.
Yeah, as you continue to tighten your belt, your opportunities get less and less.
Yeah, and I think, you know, also some people just didn't see themselves in this situation. So, you know, now with the internet, you know, a lot of young kids are on LinkedIn and they're, you know, they're on Facebook and they keep up with their friends. But I think if you've been in the workforce for a while and you know a few people, you know, you might just go to your job every day, keep your head down and come home. And I think when those people get unemployed, they don't have a wide kind of group of contacts to get a new job.
No.
And unfortunately, a lot of employment is through who you know. I mean, it shouldn't be like that. But most people don't get jobs through ads. They get jobs through contacts.
Yeah, and, you know, I look at this, and what's interesting to me, Liz, is that, you know, the people who are so adamantly opposed to extending unemployment or really any of the social safety net programs that kept us in 2008 from depression, they come from solidly red states who are the states that are suffering really the most. And, you know, I look at this and I got to ask, is there some kind of disconnect between the people who elect them and put them in the office and reality? Because, you know, you look at some of these southern states that just have huge unemployment, long-term unemployment problems, and yet you've got the same very safe politicians voting against their interests.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that there are values of independence and freedom, right? People, you know, people want to be independent. They don't want to be on a government program. And I think that it's not a bad value, but the problem is it leads to this sort of working against your own self-interest. One of the things I wanted to say about unemployment insurance is that, you know, it has a multiplier effect. So if you're unemployed and you get unemployment insurance, you can afford not to live lavishly, right, but just to survive. Once those unemployment insurance benefits cease or stop, you can't go down to the corner store and buy a donut, right? You can't go buy food. So what happens is the economy shrinks. So at EPI, we've done a study that shows that, in fact, the economy will lose 310,000 additional jobs because of unemployment benefits being cut off.
So we're going to make the situation worse.
Exactly. I mean, so the point is that if the unemployed person can't afford to buy the donut, then 7-Eleven is going to lay people off, right? Or Dunkin' Donuts or whatever.
Or if you can't buy milk or butter or sugar or bread or any of that stuff. It's a ripple effect across the whole economy is what you're saying.
Right. It has a ripple effect, and it's a downward spiral, and it is the last thing we need. You know, what we need is to invest in our schools and, you know, build the next generation. We need to invest in highways. We need to, you know, build things. Think big. I mean, our economy is growing too slowly. We need to figure out how to, you know, not keep stabbing ourselves. I mean, these are self-inflicted wounds, you know, the sector that is shrinking is the federal, well, not just federal, but the government sector, public spending. I mean, public spending could really help the economy
right.
get better.
Like here in Pennsylvania, if we had those 20,000 education professionals that were kicked to the curb because of the enormous budget cuts this governor has put into place. And, you know, maybe the health and human services people that would be employed if our governor were to accept the Medicaid expansion, that would create jobs and get us going back on the right path, if I hear you right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the beauty of government spending in a downturn is that it can help keep the economy going, but it also invests in the future. So, you know, those educators aren't just, you know, taking a paycheck. They're also educating.
Yeah, well, we don't need educated children. We need just button pushers. We need people just smart enough to push the buttons, but not smart enough to ask why. So, you know, I hear this, and look, I'm on the same page. I say we need to be investing heavily in the future, but you hear from the radical right in this country, we're broke. We don't have any money. The lights are going out. It's all over, party over. We can't afford the luxuries of education and infrastructure. Can't afford those luxuries.
Yeah, you know, the thing is we're not broke. And, you know, we are certainly not broke. And if you look at what we're spending, you know, we spend a lot of money. And in fact, you know, I would argue that we are really not broke. And in fact, you know, the deficit has been going down. You know, the deficit has not been growing the way they talk about it. There is no crisis with the deficit. So, you know, they're creating a crisis where there really isn't one.
Yeah, but, you know, it's, you know, you see the big number. And look, it is a huge number when you look at it on the side of a building, $16 trillion. And, you know, our debt problems, you know, they point to. But, you know, when you look at it in this scope of everyone likes to bring things back to kitchen table economics, it's not as bad as it appears.
Well, it's especially not as bad as it appears. But more importantly, the best way to make the deficit smaller is to put Americans back to work,
right?
Is to get the economy going. So then people will make money and people will pay taxes, and then the deficit will go down.
And for me, that comes back to
the best anti-deficit program is a full employment program.
Absolutely. And I look at the Senate has approved Janet Yellen to head the Federal Reserve. Do you think she's going to make any difference? Because I got to be honest, the Fed, I know it has the supposedly a dual function of full employment and battling inflation. It appears to me, though, over the last couple of decades, full employment hasn't really been on their mind.
Yeah, full employment has not been on their mind. I think we are hopeful that Janet Yellen will be, you know, frankly, more progressive than the last few chairs have been. I mean, honestly, I certainly don't think she's going to be worse. You know, the Fed has been one of the few parts of government pulling its weight, right? I mean, at least through the economic stimulus program of the Fed, that, you know, the bond buying program, they were the only ones doing anything. So, I mean, I think that, you know, hopefully Janet Yellen will make things better, and she certainly won't make things worse.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, and I don't think there's anyone who would disagree with the concept of full employment, the idea that, or at least anyone who's rational, that mm-hmm. if we have the ability to create jobs and to get people moving, even if it's, you know, the public sector saying, hey, we want something, and the private sector ending up doing it, that's a benefit for all of us. And then we have some, I think at the end, like high-speed internet. Our internet globally is pathetic.
Right, it's pathetic. And you know why it's pathetic? It's because we have a very deregulatory, you know, there's a reason why South Korea kicks our butt in the internet, right? I mean, these countries have policies that the government invests and they require companies to invest. You know, we have a deregulated system where the companies are allowed to charge consumers whatever they want and have, you know, a huge preference for businesses that can pay more. So the consumer gets completely screwed. And it's synergistic because having fast internet is really important for businesses and for commerce. So in order for our economy to get better, we need to have fast internet.
And it's important for people and information and all of that stuff. I mean, if it's that important, we're told that's the future. Shouldn't we be? I remember Bush saying it a number of years back that America's number 10 in the world in internet, and that's 10 spots too long. And I remember thinking, well, that's an interesting statement, but being 10.
And now we're like number 20.
Exactly. I mean, we're down on the even further down on the list because during his watch, nothing has happened, and nothing's been allowed to happen. So, you know, there's a prime example of just one thing that could get people to work.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. I think that Americans do need to start making demands. I mean, part of the reason why our government has gotten away with, you know, the reason why the internet is slow and expensive here is because Verizon and Comcast spend a lot of money here in Washington lobbying so that they can have their way. And I think that the only way that the members of Congress, they are not being yelled at about this. I mean, if people stood up and said, you know, we want faster internet, we're paying too much for it, then I think that Congress would respond and the FCC would regulate. But the problem is unless people are complaining about it, it's almost like Americans have gotten too complacent about everything.
Yeah.
Whether it
everything
is about their wages. Yeah, I mean, one of the most important items to us here at EPI is that people don't even realize their wages, even those of us who are lucky enough to have jobs, our wages have been flat. The wages have been flatlined since 1979 for everyone except the top 1%, right? Top CEOs and top executives, their wages are skyrocketing. And it doesn't have to be like this. And I think that's our mission, is just to explain to people that these economics are caused by policies. And we can demand better.
Absolutely. And I tell the story all the time. When I started working in the trucking industry to run boxes on a shipping dock back in 1988, I was making $15 an hour. The guys doing that exact job right now are making about $12. And that's not adjusted for anything. That's dollar for dollar. That's what my paycheck said back then, and that's what their check says now. No adjusted for inflation or any of that.
Yeah, and that is because, you know, policies that have helped workers have been dismantled. And, you know, the only way that's going to change is if the public gets mad about it. And that's true with, you know, whether it's your cable bill or being able to join a union, you know, whatever is important to you, it's really important to stand up because it does not have to be like this.
I'm with you. Last line of questioning I've got for you. The Senate passed this. Does this unemployment extension, does it make it out of the Senate? And when it gets to the House, does it make it out of the House? Because I don't see any appetite in the Republican-controlled John Boehner House to push this through.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the president's going to push it. I think that the Senate's going to push it. And I think, you know, again, it depends upon the public. You know, unless the public gets really upset about unemployment insurance, the House is not going to do anything. So, I mean, I personally think that being against unemployment unemployment insurance extension does make the Republicans look pretty heartless.
Yeah. Well,
so,
they are.
You know,
I mean,
yeah.
you are what you are.
There was an article in the Washington Post today about, you know, Republicans are going around doing these, you know, tours of trying to show that they care about low-income people. I mean, I think that they're looking pretty unsympathetic. So, you know, whether that matters, you know, I hope it does.
Yeah, kind of like Paul Ryan going into the soup kitchen after it was already closed to force his way into taking a photo op of washing dishes. But they didn't even want him there.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that there are unemployed people whose benefits have been cut off in everybody's district.
Right.
I mean, every Republican has. So the question is,
does it take those does it take those 1.3 million people who are going to lose their benefits immediately to do as they've done in the past, like Coxey's Army, who walked from Massillon, Ohio, to Washington, D.C., and set up camp and all over the city, set up little camps and said, we demand to be noticed right now? Is that what it's going to take?
I mean, it's interesting. I think it could take something like that, or it could take, I mean, people just need to realize it's not just the unemployment insurance that, you know, if people's, you know, it can't just be one tiny slice like unemployed people. It's got to be all of us. You know, if your kid comes home from college and has to take an unpaid internship at a company that could afford it, you know, that should change.
Your
wages should go up. People should, you know, it's almost like it can't just be one issue. It needs to be, you know, people need to unite around a whole group of issues having to do with workers and wages.
That we need a new deal, if you will. Liz Rose, it's always great talking with you, Communications Director over at the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Always great. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
It comes down, and you know, I think we hit on it with Liz there a minute ago. It comes down to full employment policies, bottom line, pretty simple stuff. In fact, you know, to me, it comes down to our trade policies. And you look at the trade numbers that were just released today. We had a trade deficit of $34.3 billion in the month of October. And you think about, you know, if we had those jobs here, if we were buying stuff from ourselves, what would that mean for economic activity? You think about this year, 2013 to date, and that isn't November or December yet, there is a trade deficit with China of $293.9 billion, well ahead of the $290.6 billion of 2012. That's an awful lot of redistribution of wealth from us to the Chinese and, of course, to the American corporations who hoard their money overseas. It's that simple. Quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For the homeless or the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's really a corporate extortion plan by Boeing trying to make aerospace a race to the bottom. 7,000 to 8,000 members didn't vote on it, and it was such a slim margin. 300 votes either way would have changed it. That means about 37.5% of the members actually got to decide the fate for the next 10 years, which erases 78 years of collective bargaining history.
International Association of Machinists, District 751 spokesperson Connie Kelleher. Many IAM District 751 Boeing machinists are very angry about the vote forced on them by their international union that destroyed defined benefit pensions, increased health care costs, and diminished wages. Some members have filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board and are demanding a revote when a true majority of IAM Boeing members would have a chance to cast ballots. Kelleher says that due to members being away on holidays vacation, about 25% of members didn't vote on this concessionary contract proposal.
Members are very upset. There's been a huge outcry since Friday's vote was announced from members calling for a revote. Our international president forced this vote under the guise of he wanted the members to have the final say on it. Well, if you want the members to have it, don't pick a day where you know 25 to 30% of them are not available. A lot of people are very upset and have gone to the NLRB. They are passing around petitions that they want to call for a revote when truly a majority of the members could determine the fate. Our international president has said all along that he responds to hearing from the members, so right now the members are busy speaking up and letting him hear them.
Kelleher says the contract Boeing forced on workers under threat of moving the production of the 777X airliner was corporate extortion that squeezed both the workers and $8.7 billion in tax concessions from Washington State. And she says despite this being portrayed as giving up pensions and other concessions in return for guaranteed jobs, there is no real ironclad jobs guarantee for future Washington State union jobs from Boeing in this contract.
For a two-paragraph language giving us the airplane. The first sentence says we get the work, and the next two paragraphs give them loopholes to move it. It not only gave up the defined benefit pension, it destroyed the health care, really. The premiums will go up 300% by the end, copays will double, all policies drop to 90% coverage on everything. In addition, wage growth is cut by 75% from the current contract, which was only a 2% wage increase each year. It'll now be 1% every other year, and then it'll go 3 years.
Meanwhile, Boeing is making record profits. The CEO got a 20% raise last year, and he has a pension that will pay him $265,000 a month when he retires, and a supplemental pension on top of that. IAM International President Tom Buffenbarger was not available for an interview, but the International says the $8.7 billion in legislative incentives in Washington State are contingent on Boeing remaining in Puget Sound.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Gotta find a way to hold them to account. Before they find a way to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us?
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So it was yesterday, the 73rd anniversary of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's the Four Freedoms speech, also the Second Bill of Rights, this idea that you should have freedom from want, freedom from fear, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. You know, these things that I think, you know, universally, we're in favor of, and you combine that with tomorrow in history, you've got the war on poverty by President Johnson. Right now, we're kind of in that same time frame where we need to be talking about what the future has for us. And what I've got Harvey Kay on the line. He's a professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He's written the book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Harvey, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I always like talking to you, Rick.
You know, I look at this, just this amazing time in history that we're sandwiched between the Four Freedoms speech and this idea that we should have a second Bill of Rights and, of course, Johnson's war on poverty. Do we need the next part three, if you will?
You know, it's fascinating to consider that we are at this moment where we have these anniversaries. And we're in this new year, 2014, and we've got congressional elections on the horizon, and a presidential election coming up in a couple of years, and we know what's at stake. And what's at stake is that this memory of ours, of the four freedoms, is what we need to advance. You know, you were saying freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. In fact, you know, the more I've been thinking about it, the more I'm convinced we need a scorecard. We progressives, we labor people, we need a scorecard. We need to start assessing our politicians, conservatives and liberals, in terms of how much they're doing to advance those four freedoms. And maybe at the same time, we ought to be mobilizing ourselves to push them in that direction.
Yeah, you know, I look at the title of your book, and it's right there. You know, what made FDR and the greatest generation truly great? I think of my grandparents' generation who, you know, right in the middle of that, who, you know, came back from World War II, fought fascism, fought the war, but came home and fought for a middle class, fought for opportunity for their children, and a legacy for their future that has really very quickly been eroded and destroyed by, in my view, the very well-to-do of this country.
Well, absolutely. You know, even in the darkest days of the Depression of the 1930s, Roosevelt called on his fellow citizens, and working people responded with their labors in the New Deal, organized labor unions, placed their lives on the line to make sure that their rights were recognized. I mean, they created the middle class starting in the 1930s when they redeemed the United States from the Great Depression. And when they went off to fight in World War II, they went off to fight not only to defend the United States, but to advance freedom, equality, and democracy at home, which they did. Even at home, they were increasing the size of the labor movement, they were expanding the consumer movement, and they were fighting for civil rights. And when they came back from the war, inspired by those four freedoms and Roosevelt's call for a second Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights, they came home and they had to confront the rich and the powerful who were eager to suppress those aspirations. But they pushed on. And in fact, in many ways, that war on poverty truly is an extension of that original struggle for the New Deal and the rights of labor and the creation of Social Security. I mean, think about it. You've got public employees organizing in the 1960s. You've got the war on poverty. You've got Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65. What an incredible generation. From 1935 to 1965, transformed America,
and not just America, but globally. I mean, everyone was looking to us as, you know, this is the model we should be pursuing globally. And now I see us as the leader of, well, the race to the bottom instead of the top.
For the last 40 years, we've allowed corporate America to represent and dictate to working America. And now, 2014, it's time to start demanding of ourselves the struggle for the four freedoms, the fight for the four freedoms. I mean, the reason we titled it The Fight for the Four Freedoms is that it's not something that just came out of a speech by Roosevelt. These were struggles that began in the 30s, continued through the 60s, and it's time to redeem them.
So do we have the political will? I mean, I look at what's going on in Washington. Just with a very simple vote on extending emergency unemployment benefits, 3 months, that's the best they could come up with. And I got to wonder, what pound of flesh did the working class give up? What's in the details? Just to get that very meager sum pushed forward to help folks who are struggling.
You know, even as we, you know, all the surveys, all the polls show that Americans want the four freedoms. They want to advance freedom, equality, and democracy. And yet every day we open the newspaper to some more news about the class war from above, whether it has to do with the Republicans refusing to extend unemployment benefits to the fact that Boeing demands that its workers give up their pension plans. I mean, you know, when are we going to start demanding of our politicians that they represent us? When are we going to mobilize to demand a democratic America that we believe in?
Let me ask you this, Harvey, because, you know, I look at this, and, you know, FDR and Johnson have been given a lot of credit for, you know, the New Deal and for the Second Bill of Rights and, of course, the War on Poverty, as it was their idea. I'm of the mindset that, you know, they didn't do it because they wanted to. They did it because there was a movement, a growth of people, a groundswell, a grassroots organizing of folks who are saying, this is what we want, this is what you do, and we're going to force you to do it.
Well, you know, oddly enough, we could say that in 1930, Roosevelt wrote to a friend, and he said, in the midst of the Great Depression, in this letter, he said, "I think it's time for America to become radical for a generation." But he knew full well there was no way that America becomes radical for a generation from the top down. And it, over and over again in his speeches, responding to the grassroots, the labor movement, and other struggles of working people for consumer rights, over and over again, he invites Americans to demand more. He once, in 1935, I think it was, he said, "The law does not bring a new millennium," which is to say, you have to make these things happen.
Right.
He understood that he needed to be pushed in order to bring about a more democratic America.
So bring this to the present day for me, because, you know, you look at income inequality right back to where we were during the days of the...
We're back into the 1920s.
Right. I mean, you see this, you see poverty at rates almost to where they were before Johnson proposed the war on poverty. I saw the 15% is where it is now. It was 19% when Johnson proposed this. And I guess the question I've got to ask, because we keep hearing from folks on the right that none of those programs worked. It's my view they worked really well until you had conservative, both the Democrat and Republican conservative pro-business policies that went after to destroy them.
Well, you know, it's interesting. They claim the New Deal didn't work, but out of the New Deal and the labor struggles of the 1930s, American inequality decreased. Government took on a new role in enhancing the lives of citizens. The war on poverty was terribly underfunded, did not provide jobs, but even then, given the initiatives like Medicare, Medicaid, which were part of an expansion of Social Security, the poverty rate declined in the late 60s into the early 70s. And you're right, it's only when the conservative agenda prevails that we see this sort of rapid increase in inequality, and with that rapid increase in inequality, working people become working poor. Working poor become poor.
Do you see the signs that there's going to be the kind of groundswell of working folks saying, you know, we've had enough? You know, I've been doing a lot of research about the Depression and what, you know, led up to the New Deal and all that. And, you know, this country, for, you know, people who don't know, we were in major turmoil. There were thousands and millions of people in the streets, and we were being torn apart from within. And a lot of this stuff
Right. I mean, when's the last time you've heard of a major strike wave in America? When's the last time? I mean, the fact is that we have got to start organizing.
Yep.
Okay. And I think especially, you know, I want to hear I'm a labor man. I belong to two unions. I want to hear labor leaders demand action, not of Republicans. They're not going to give way.
Nope.
They have to start demanding action of Democrats and the executive branch of Obama. That's the way it's got to happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing is, you know, I want those people out in the streets. I want people being whipped up into a frenzy, because that seems to be the only way anything ever gets done.
Well, they don't listen if you don't shout.
Good point. But, you know, at the end of this, I'm looking at the way things are going, and these little bits and pieces that we seem to be happy taking these crumbs. And I got to say, when's that going to stop? When do we...
Well, you know what? I'm convinced that it's too easy. And over again, the liberal and left magazines decry the Republicans. We have got to start decrying the state of the Democratic Party.
I agree.
We have got to start creating a party that truly is the party of working people. We've got to remake the Democratic Party. And then we have to, I want to hear Trumka and others speaking out. They still have great bully pulpits to work from. They still have resources. No more giving monies to politicians who don't advance the fight for the four freedoms.
And do you see that movement? I mean, I'm...
Well, we can... I mean, I understand... What I read, what I sense, even among my students, is not simply exasperation, but a sense of waiting to act now. I have to grant, you know, and not to make light of it, but the fact is it's probably too cold to go outside right now.
Good point.
But this spring, we ought to see mobilizations this spring. We ought to see things happening. I mean, we've got a congressional election on the horizon. There's too much at stake.
I'm with you.
I mean, there's just too much at stake. Inequality is far too great. Poverty has expanded. Look, voting rights are being threatened. I mean, how many different things can we point to? The four freedoms are under siege.
And if you want to take a look at Harvey's book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Harvey Kaye's name. It'll take you right to the spot where you can pick it up. The book, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Last question I've got for you. You know, you look at what's going on. You look at history. Do we have hope? I mean,
a lot of what we see
is depressing. A lot of what we see is something to not be hopeful about. But are you optimistic?
I am when I cease to be optimistic, I cease to be a progressive.
There you go. Harvey, it's great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. As always, you know, great stuff.
Thanks, Rick. I'll never get to bed tonight now.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Okay,
again, the
care.
Book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Harvey Kaye's name. It'll take you right there. But take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Attention class, here's today's new word, native advertising. Okay, that's two words, but it's one concept, and it has nothing to do with native people. Rather, it's a phrase sprung on us by the wonky wordsmiths of internet media, who also refer to it as, quote, brand content. Meaning that these particular web pages are not articles, but paid advertising. But they don't want to be too explicit about distinguishing between genuine news items and ad hustles. Why not? Money, of course. In today's fledgling web publications, from such newbies as BuzzFeed to the digital versions of old-line pubs like the New York Times, there's been a blurring of the line between the publication's legitimate journalistic content and the faux stories that are provided by marketers and designed to look like real articles from non-biased news sources. For readers and viewers, the questions are obvious. Whose stuff is this, and what can I trust? The best ethical response by online publishers would be to draw a bright line around all branded content. Perhaps with some flashing neon lights and honking horns to announce, this is an ad. But no, while internet publishers say they seek journalistic integrity, they're hungrier still for advertisers' dollars. So their game is to flash just enough integrity without losing the bucks. That's a losing game for integrity. Media analyst Bob Garfield notes that the very effectiveness of native advertising depends on it being confused with editorial content. Eliminate the confusion, and the ethical failure diminishes, he says, but what will also diminish to near vanishing point is the readership of those adverts. This is Jim Hightower saying, any media so dependent on corporate money that it resorts to deceiving its audience is, in a word, dependent. Also, untrustworthy. We need public financing to free the independence of journalism on the web.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I look at that whole Four Freedoms thing, and, you know, the reality is, in my view, something we should have been fighting for all along. You know, as each generation, and I guess it goes back to my grandfather, who, instilled in me this idea that, tomorrow is a better day and that we're working for tomorrow, working for our children. This idea that, community is important, that building a better country. And, this is where, you know, I hear my friends that, you know, the states' rights and all we care about is hooray for me. Where I go back to this idea that, you know, we're all Americans. And I know sometimes for progressives or liberals, we get labeled with this, you know, oh, you're not enough of a flag waver. You're not enough of a patriot. And I firmly and wholeheartedly disagree with that. And every liberal, progressive, every thinking person who allows someone to attach that kind of a label to them needs to stand up and shout from the top of the mountain that's not true. Reality being what reality is, I believe I'm as patriotic as anyone because I believe in our country. I believe that we should be investing in our people. And, you know, go back to the trade policy thing, which I know I'm huge on. It's to me, what's caused a vast majority of our inequality. It's what's caused the majority of our debt problems. You look at the fact $296 billion trade deficit with one country. And, you know, I've gone back and you just do the simple math of, you know, from the 1970s when we began running these huge trade deficits. Had we had something of balanced trade, we wouldn't have the debt problems we have. We wouldn't have a lot of the problems we have. And I found it interesting that today, Chief Justice John Roberts, you gotta love this. It's one of those things that just makes me, because if you remember all the screwquester and all the budget cutting that went on, you had people saying, well, we need to cut spending. And what's 2 or 3 or 5%? Oh, anyone can do that. Anyone can make that kind of a cut. Well, according to the Chief Justice, the cuts that are coming to the Supreme Court, to the federal judiciary, well, it's going to be extremely painful. In fact, in his annual report, Roberts warns of the ongoing impact of automatic spending cuts that went into effect back in March, known as screwquester. He's saying that the 5% budget cut, the reduction in their funding, is about $350 million, about a $350 million cut in their $6.6 billion budget, and that's led to reductions in the number of people that work there, the court clerks, the probation and pretrial service people, the public defenders. He says the future would be bleak if the cuts were to go into maintain in effect. It would lead to the loss of an estimated 1,000 court employees. That would be because the judiciary would have to cut funding from some areas to counter other inflation-driven costs, he says. Now, look, at the end of it, you say, okay, well, where are you going to get the money from? Because Congress, they keep telling us we're broke. Because understand, it was $6.6 billion. Before the screwquester cuts, then the $3.5 million they took away. The judiciary is asking Congress for $7.04 billion for 2014. And that, may not be enough to operate the court system efficiently. And you know, you kind of go back to this idea that our Republican friends working very hard, really to drag government into the bathtub and drown it. The court system being one of them. For years, you've heard conservatives whining about activist judges, even though Roberts is one of them. And now Roberts, I think, has awakened to the idea that, well, he's on the cutting block. That it's his department that's being cut. And, you know, it's always easy to cut somebody else's funding. It's always easy to take food out of someone else's children's mouth. It's always easy to take something off of somebody else's table. But when it's your own, well, that's a whole nother ball of wax, isn't it? You know, much like this whole discussion over the unemployment. You know, you've got the Republicans running around saying, well, we want offsets. We want to make sure that it's paid for by taking from someone else, taking from other programs. And you know where it's going to come from. It's going to come from the programs that the unemployed probably were using, that they needed, or programs that would help people get off of unemployment. That's how our Congress seems to work. And, you know, it just leaves me kind of shaking my head, wondering, what's it going to take? Now, for me, I think I've said this a million times before. We as a society need to change our focus. We need to change what it is that's important to us. That whole schmuck dynasty thing, the bearded people who, I guess, didn't have beards before, you know, who knows? We need to stop looking at the shiny stuff and start being focused on what's really important. And I think Harvey Kay pointed out some very, very interesting things about the four freedoms, about the second. Maybe we need a third Bill of Rights modeled after the first two. Maybe we need to be talking about, you know, as a working person, what's the minimum we're going to allow in society? You know, I think of this, you know, often. You know, if you're working for a living, you're punching that clock. You're playing by their rules. What's the minimum we're going to allow in this society? How bad should things be allowed to be? And next year, when the trade deficit continues to go up because we're negotiating more neoliberal trade policies that are going to send more of our jobs overseas and cause more of a downward spiral in our wage structure, what's that going to look like? Because understand, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement is front and center. It's basically negotiated. They're just trying to figure out a way and a time when we'll be distracted again. Maybe another Duck Dynasty thing. Maybe, you know, maybe we'll come up with another idiotic comment by someone who I could care less about. And we'll get all worked up and focused on that while they're doing the things that they do. You know, my grandparents' generation, you know, my grandfather, who, while not a very educated person, made it all the way up until the middle of the eighth grade, I found out. I thought he finished eighth grade. No, it was actually, he made it to the middle of the eighth grade before he had to go to work and support the family. He was able to, and, you know, my aunt and I were just talking about this over the weekend. You know, what could he have done with an education and with the push and the drive? Because he was a smart guy. But it came from street smarts. It came from, they used to say, the school of hard knocks. It came from understanding how things really are. Not what's being spoon-fed to us, because a lot of what's gone on, we're spoon-fed. We're inundated with this message that, oh, free trade is good. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not seeing it. What I'm seeing is a massive redistribution of wealth from our country as a whole to the Chinese and to elsewhere. And ultimately into the hands of the corporate citizens. You know, the corporate elite who have so much money that no country would dare not take them. That they could have, you know, lunch in France and dinner in Russia and, you know, hop around the world. At the expense of the people who create that wealth. My grandfather's generation, like laser, you want to talk about laser-like focus? They were able to cut through the nonsense, cut through the BS, and get to the heart of the issue, which is decent working conditions, decent wages, retirement security, a future for their children, and a wealth class and a business class that paid its taxes, that paid for investment. When will we as a thinking society, if it's possible, I don't even know if it's possible, when will we as a thinking society say, you know, enough already? We've tried, really, we've tried the Reaganomics, we've tried trickle down, we've tried free trade, we've tried tax cuts beyond imagination. We've deregulated, we've re-regulated, we've unregulated. And what's it gotten us? Well, it's gotten us a lower standard of living. It's gotten us a more unstable economy. And it's made that gulf between those who have and those who do not that much greater. So as I think about it, it comes down to us. It comes down to us saying, you know, enough already. And, you know, saying, we're going to stick together. We're going to move forward and we're going to fight. I'll take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's really a corporate extortion plan by Boeing trying to make aerospace a race to the bottom. 7,000 to 8,000 members didn't vote on it, and it was such a slim margin. 300 votes either way would have changed it. That means about 37.5% of the members actually got to decide the fate for the next 10 years, which erases 78 years of collective bargaining history.
International Association of Machinists, District 751 spokesperson Connie Kelleher. Many IAM District 751 Boeing machinists are very angry about the vote forced on them by their international union that destroyed defined benefit pensions, increased health care costs, and diminished wages. Some members have filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board and are demanding a re-vote when a true majority of IAM Boeing members would have a chance to cast ballots. Kelleher says that due to members being away on holidays vacation, about 25% of members didn't vote on this concessionary contract proposal.
Members are very upset. There's been a huge outcry since Friday's vote was announced from members calling for a revote. Our international president forced this vote under the guise of he wanted the members to have the final say on it. Well, if you want the members to have the final say, don't pick a day where you know 25 to 30% of them are not available. A lot of people are very upset and have gone to the NLRB. They are passing around petitions that they want to call for a revote when truly a majority of the members could determine the fate. Our international president has said all along that he responds to hearing from the members, so right now the members are busy speaking up and letting him hear them.
Kelleher says the contract Boeing forced on workers under threat of moving the production of the 777X airliner was corporate extortion that squeezed both the workers and $8.7 billion in tax concessions from Washington State. And she says despite this being portrayed as giving up pensions and other concessions in return for guaranteed jobs, there is no real ironclad jobs guarantee for future Washington State union jobs from Boeing in this contract.
For a two-paragraph language giving us the airplane. The first sentence says we get the work, and the next two paragraphs give them loopholes to move it. It not only gave up the defined benefit pension, it destroyed the health care, really. The premiums will go up 300% by the end, copays will double, all policies drop to 90% coverage on everything. In addition, wage growth is cut by 75% from the current contract, which was only a 2% wage increase each year. It'll now be 1% every other year, and then it'll go 3 years.
Meanwhile, Boeing is making record profits. The CEO got a 20% raise last year, and he has a pension that will pay him $265,000 a month when he retires, and a supplemental pension on top of that. IAM International President Tom Buffenbarger was not available for an interview, but the International says the $8.7 billion in legislative incentives in Washington State are contingent on Boeing remaining in Puget Sound.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I get a lot of flack from emailers occasionally over this, over the fact that I don't watch much television. I didn't get all tied up in the Schmuck Dynasty nonsense and who said what, because I think it was all a major distraction and a publicity stunt to hawk their guns to the faithful. But someone sent me an email saying, this is a show you've got to see. This is, it's an amazing show on TLC. And they also, I guess, showed it the first time on the channel Discovery Fit and Health. which I didn't even know existed, but okay. It is under the guise of, you know, the Untold Story ER. This is a different one. Sex. Sent me to the ER. And it's a whole bunch of reenactments of, I would have to guess, urban-type legend things, like, you know, having your head pounded through a wall. Don't we have anything better to do? Well, I guess you need the distraction from what's going on in Washington and in Harrisburg and around the globe, which is why we've asked Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service, to come fill us in on the goings-on of the day. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks. I don't watch TV, but I that's the only I watched that.
You did?
I swear, I don't watch TV, period. I watched that. That's
well,
so
we,
weird.
Well, we
by
know.
Accident, by accident.
Oh, of course, it was by accident.
I did. That's hilarious.
And was it any good? I mean, I got to be honest, I looked at it and I said, it's all reenactments. I mean, it's got to be kind of campy. And did it hold your attention?
Yeah, there was a couple of funny ones.
Anything you've done?
No. I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe in my drinking days. I don't know.
So there's some value there in your mind?
No, but, you know, I watched... The only other show I watched is Judge Judy, okay? So.
All right. Well, I don't want to have to... I don't want to pair the two of those together. The thought,
no,
that would those
visual.
Thoughts would keep me up at night. No,
yeah.
Thank you. But, you know, speaking of keeping us up at night, I know a lot of families after the first of the year were worried that they weren't going to be able to put food on the table because the unemployment extension not going to, what didn't look like it was going to happen, still doesn't look like it's going to happen to me. The SNAP benefits still don't look like they're going to happen. A lot of unsettled folks. But a step forward maybe today in the Senate, right?
That's correct. Today was kind of like, I call it sort of economic day. You had the Senate, which moved the bill to extend the unemployment benefits. The House may do it, but they want it to be paid for. And where's it going to come from? That's going to be what they're going to argue. There'll be a Commerce Committee of argument between two chambers. The second thing is Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the Senate, as soon as this is all done, is going to really push forward and launch on minimum wage. And combined with the president's announcement today at the White House of his anti-poverty program, of a couple of ideas he has, and then to top it all off, they are actually inching close to an agreement between the House and Senate key budget people, which is Barbara McCall and, of course, Hal Rogers, the Appropriations Chairman, House Republican. So it was a kind of economic day, and it's making the Republicans a bit upset, by the way, Rick, because of the fact that they have to, you know, come up against trying to justify not extending unemployment.
Right.
But also, it takes this away from Obamacare.
But, you know, I heard today you had McConnell coming out and saying, well, we'll extend it, but Obamacare should be done. We'll extend it for 3 months, but Obamacare has to go away for a year.
Please. Haven't they learned from Ted Cruz? You can't tie votes on public policy to this Obamacare for the rest of our lives, you know?
Sure we can.
Well, they can, but it's not going to work.
I know, but, you know, and I look at this and I go, at some point, the fact that we're talking about economic inequality, the fact that maybe someone on the Republican side has realized that they're going to get their hats handed to them, or at least their heads handed to them at some point, if you don't at least leave a couple of crumbs on the floor for the people who made the bread.
And what they could do if they would not argue over the unemployment extension... minimum wage, I mean, they could take it up too far, and that could be argued, you know, possibly, you know, obviously against that. But if they would go along with the unemployment extension and then, frankly, come up with some ideas, which they would have to, you know, go against some of corporate America, if they would do that, they might be able to actually, you know, lay this at the feet of the Democratic side, but they're not going to do that. They'll somehow embroil themselves in one particular issue, like McConnell's statement, for example, and really blow a lot of opportunity to make some good policy.
No, I mean, today it's an interesting day today, because yesterday was the day FDR gave his Four Freedoms speech, you know, basically a second Bill of Rights, and tomorrow is the day that Lyndon Baines Johnson began the war on poverty. So, you know, we're kind of in the middle of this, taking a look at where we are now? Because in my view, and I don't know where you stand, I look at both ideas, both from FDR and from LBJ, as successes. I mean, the fact that we were doing very well in alleviating poverty and making poverty, well, at least lessen.
I think, and people, you know, I'm from Appalachia, and the district I represented was Appalachia, and people talk about LBJ and a war on poverty, and he made it worse, et cetera, but a lot of strides are particular areas of Appalachia, frankly. It seems that a lot of things started to go down the tubes, too, with trade deals and loss of manufacturing base mm-hmm. and good union pay jobs.
See, to me, all of it comes back to under those neoliberal trade policies in the late 70s and really through the 80s.
The trade policies were the most destructive items that I think we've viewed in years. And until somebody starts to get serious, you know, about the manufacturing jobs, but this is one of the problems Republicans will have, Rick, because in order to do that, remember, you know, companies come in, they love those trade bills. They'll tell you they want to sell, you know, a million telephones to help their business and help Americans. They want to make a million telephones in China, not sell them to China, make them there.
Yeah. And you know where they're coming back to. And we've heard this before. And the sad reality is, and I guess it's because of, you know, the prosperity this nation has had in the past, that we're still viewed as the consumer of last resort, and that people think that well's never going to run dry. And I look around and I'm going, folks, most of the people I know, most of the people in my area, they're struggling to make it to the next week.
Well, people are having to readjust because of prices gone up, inflation, et cetera. And at the end of the day, credit cards have risen, and you just can't spend the money. But at one point in time, we were overheating on it, spending, and China knew that and played into it. And then the trade deals absolutely killed us.
Yeah, and yet we've been focused on all of these ancillary issues. Can't talk about the money, though. But you brought up the minimum wage a second ago. Do you think there's going to be some movement in this Congress? Because I don't see Boehner and the Republicans having any appetite to raise the meager $7.25 minimum wage anywhere higher.
No, there won't be. There won't be under Boehner, because Boehner picks and chooses as Speaker. You know, oh, okay, I'll throw this out for a vote, and whatever happens, to pass, he will hold them for a vote. That's minimum wage.
And, you know, to me, more than really any time that I can remember, the minimum wage right now is pathetically low. And really, to get the economy moving, I think you have to do something to boost income growth somehow, even if it's you boost the floor up a little bit.
We have a history that we can look back on with minimum wage also, Rick. We have a history to it, because you always hear the generic, oh, it'll take jobs, or you'll hear, you know, the opposite, it creates millions of jobs. You know, you'll hear both, but we have statistical history on this that separates fact from fiction.
Right.
And it's $7.25 is the minimum wage, which is so low.
I have no idea, and this may be snobbery on my part, but I have no idea how you exist. Not live, just exist on $7.25. And the sad reality is you go to the homeless shelters in cities across this country, and they are riddled with people who are working the minimum wage jobs that we're allowing to exist. And, you know, you think of all of the government subsidies and all of our tax dollars that subsidize this low wage economy. At some point, we have to have that adult conversation of, are we going to continue to subsidize the Walmarts and the McDonald's and all of these low-wage employers, or are we going to make them pay their employees so that they can live, not just survive?
Well, and of that $1,200 a month a person would make, you know, you do have most of the cities charge a 1% at least, or possibly 2% tax, and then when you just take out basic rent and gasoline, you know, as you know, try making a car payment or something on that. I mean, it's not a livable wage. They say minimum, but really the talk ought to be the phraseology livable wage.
So why are our Republican friends not there? I mean, you know, I keep hearing this, you know, and I'm a firm believer in that there's respect and dignity in any work. I don't care what you do. You get up, you punch a clock, you do your job, you do what you're paid for. There should be dignity and respect, and you should be able to put food on the table, a roof over your head, Why the party who tells us of, you know, meritocracy, the party of personal responsibility, why is it that they seem to demonize people who may not have the skills that they have but still are working? I mean, that's the thing that gets me. These are people who are still working.
Well, I mean, you know, everybody is a capitalistic society, and, you know, people want the business to create jobs, but the problem with the Republicans has been that they just toe the line of, well, you know, don't do that because it hurts the businesses, where at the end of the day, you know, the businesses don't always pass along the fruits and benefits, you know, to a lot of people. So they just toe an old line and an old line of thinking, and really there's a lot of businesses that might yell a little bit, but at the end of the day, they know, too, that people have to have a livable wage. And all the past, when you look at the rhetoric of this will collapse these businesses and these jobs, it never, ever happened.
Nope, never. And but, you know, for me, this is where I think things are bad enough, and you're seeing organizing going on. You're seeing the fast food workers and the Walmart workers and the retail workers beginnings of organizing. And to me, that's the right place. We should be organizing every workplace so that you go, hey, let's sit down, let's look at the books, let's see what's available, and let's divvy up the wealth that we create. If you could pay it, absolutely you have to. Now look, I don't think anybody's going to want $100 an hour if it's not there, but you know what? If it is, I think the workers should have a share in it.
And I think that, you know, any reasonable movement on the minimum wage, you know, will have some support. But again, with the economy the way it is, it's good public policy to help people. But the way the economy is, if the Republicans were smart, they would actually put together something substantive that helps the average person out. And the average person will help them out.
What do you think a reasonable increase in the minimum wage would be?
I think you could stagger it in, for example. It's at $7.25, you know, right now. So it could go up to, let's say, an immediate rise to $8. And then it could stagger in over, let's say, a 2 or 3 year period. Let's say 2 is probably better.
Right, to a maximum of?
$12 you could go up to. You could go up to 11. I mean, you could.
Wow, you got to get you back in Congress.
Well, I mean, you could play with the figures, but if you stagger it in, people prepare for it. You can only go so far. I understand there is an inflationary factor, but inflation has happened without people getting wages.
Right. No, absolutely.
So how much could it hurt?
Yeah, I'm with you. And then you index it for inflation so we don't have to continue to have these battles every couple of years. So that you know what, hey, as inflation goes up, the costs go up, people's wages keep up with it.
Take this from an insider in the Congress 11 years. By the way, the congressional pay raises are indexed for inflation, and they are automatic unless Congress stops it. I wanted to note that.
It's important.
Congress has automatic pay raises indexed unless they stop the raise. It automatically kicks in.
Well, that's because they're so much more superior to those low-wage workers.
So, I mean, when you think about that for a second, they have an automatic. How could they vote against having an automatic for the citizens? They get it themselves.
I'm not begrudging
them if they do the work, but my goodness.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing with health care, though. I you could make that same argument for health care.
They've taken the Obama health care, except they're fully subsidizing it, so they actually haven't taken it.
Yeah. Or here in this state, the legislators here, they have a lifetime, if they've reached 10 years, they have lifetime long-term health care, which means if they have to go to a nursing home, it's covered.
Again, I don't begrudge somebody if they do a good job and they're an office holder, but you know what? Don't take it away from everybody else.
I'm right there with you. And you'll never hear me say you don't deserve something. I say, hey, how do we make sure that everyone has access to it? It's that simple. Last thing I wanted to bring up is, you know, things are not looking really good in Iraq. I see a lot of finger pointing, most of it going back to Obama. What's going on and whose doorstep is the blame going to?
You know, the president did really what George Bush said he would do as far as removal of troops. You know, President Bush always said he had an exit plan, so I don't see any big variance as if, you know, Obama did something different when he became president. But if you really want to look at the facts of this, and this is a fact, Donald Rumsfeld, under George Bush, dismantled the entire, anybody that was a Baptist, quote, which it was everybody, you had to be a Baptist if you were in the Army or the police, that entire ball of wax was dismantled. It was a huge mistake. The historians know that. The military people know that. Rumsfeld dismantled the whole ball of wax, gave them their guns, took away their paychecks, and set them loose. They never recovered from that. So even with the current government, which is not paying attention to the Sunni element over there, it's just the Shiite run, I understand that's a problem. But at the end of the day, too, you know, the military, it was disbanded, and they just were set back years upon years trying to put it back together.
So
huge
it would be-
mistake.
So to bring it home, let's say we kicked everybody out of our military. I said, here, take your guns, go, but you're never going to be able to find a job because we've put such a stink on you. No one's ever going to hire you, but here, have your gun, and then expect them to be peaceful.
And take away their paycheck, and then, you know, and then you have no infrastructure, and then all of a sudden America goes, you know, wild for a few years, and then you try to rebuild a police department in the military. That's what happened in Iraq.
That whole misadventure from the beginning, and I said it when it started, it was a huge mistake, and it has gotten nothing but worse. And I agree.
Nobody ever tried to correct the problem of the bad information given to us, and why did they do that? Nobody ever pursued that.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
I agreed with Colin Powell, you break it, you bought it. I agreed with Dick Cheney back in the 90s when he said, if we go in there, nobody will be with us. You know, I still don't know how Cheney changed his mind, but... I guess it's the Halliburton profit margin. Just is what it is. Bob, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In the plan we have defended from all things that are cruel.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.theRickSmithShow.com.
If you take a what I would call a reasonable scientific approach to that, we believe those consequences are manageable. They do require us to begin to exert or spend more policy effort on adaptation. And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting. Okay, so we will adapt to this.
But I got to tell you, I'm not feeling the heat right now. I stepped outside during the break for a second, and it's cold. Cold. Like I said earlier, I actually saw teenagers walking around with their pants around their waist, not around their ankles. Just, wow. But I know. There's no such thing as global warming. Yeah, I was coming back from Wheeling, West Virginia over the weekend, and there's a huge billboard on the way back with a clown face saying that I still believe in global warming. I do believe in climate change, but, you know, it's kind of hard on a day like today. My goodness, freezing. Anyway, our quote of the day comes from Rand Paul. You know, back in April of last year, Rand had an interesting statement. He said, I've never argued against any technology being used when you have an imminent threat, an active crime going on. If someone comes out of a liquor store with a weapon and $50 in cash, I don't care if a drone kills him or a policeman kills him. And you go, okay, well, nice sentiment there. Now we find out that there are 10 places across the country where they're going to be testing drones here in the U.S. Not the kind that are going to be shooting people down, not the Predator drones, not the Global Hawk, or any of the other long-range spy things. But what we're going to see is little spy planes, little eyes in the sky, keeping an eye on everyone. And again, you got to ask the question, is it something we should be pursuing? Do we have some reasonable expectation of privacy? Evidently, the University of Alaska is going to be one of the places where the test site will be. Also, the state of Nevada has got a couple of places across their state. Going to be, again, you're going to have private corporations doing some of this. New York's Griffith International Airport going to have a place. North Dakota's Department of Commerce, they've authorized the place. University of Texas A&M at Corpus Christi, they're going to be working on. And, of course, Virginia Polytechnical Institute, they're going to be using some of this. You know, across these states where the applicants have been approved by the FAA, they think that they're going to be able to make this workable with the FAA. I got to be honest, I'm not sold on the idea of having drones everywhere. Now, we're not talking about the ones that are going to be shooting people and have bombs and all this. We're talking about, constant surveillance. We're talking about at some point police departments putting drones over every road and with cameras, keeping an eye on everything. And I know, I've heard it like 1,000 times before that, if you're not doing anything wrong, Rick, nobody will pay attention. You shouldn't be worried if someone's watching you if you're not doing it. Well, I kind of wonder. It just is what it is. And as the next couple of days go by, make sure you pay attention and thank those folks who are out on the roads salting and the folks who are out there keeping the roads open and clear and safe and the folks who are out there helping us. Yeah, I look at these times and, in workers who are out in this nonsense, I don't envy people who work outside right now. It is what it is. The last thing I want to leave you with, evidently in Cambodia, the folks there have been saying, they've been working in the garment industry, have been saying, we've been exploited long enough. And the reason I bring this up is I think, we better pay attention. With all of the things we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan about crowd control and with drones coming online, evidently on Friday, you had Cambodian garment workers taken to the streets saying, hey, we want better wages, better hours, better conditions. We want, some say we want to organize. Heaven forbid that happen. Well, the police there shot and killed 3 people in the middle of the street. Sad, sad stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. Download the program, take it on your go. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me also, rick@thericksmithshow.com. RicksmithShow.com. Have a great night. Stay warm. Stay warm and help somebody out. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com.